All right, welcome back, everybody. It is the Dom and Colin podcast, and a very special episode we have for you today. First of all, I'm Colin, alongside Dom, as always. Dom, how are you doing?
As the by far the less important Dom in this conversation, I'm not doing too bad.
That's excellent. And yeah, we have a kind of a confusing situation potentially on our hands today, because joining us is someone that you guys, of course, all know from his appearance on Survivor Ghost Island. Welcome to the podcast, Dominic Abate. Dominic, how are you doing?
What's up, guys? Dom and Colin hanging out.
I think we'll
be all right with the two Doms. I'm sure this is probably the first time in history there's two Doms on one podcast, but
I have a solution. I think if I'm ever referring to Dom or Dominic, I'm talking to you, Dom Abate, and okay. If I ever want Dom Harvey's attention, Dom, your new name is Domathan.
Oh, geez. Let me just stop you for a sec, just so you know. Kristen's father and her brother's names are also Dominic. So So there's me, my brother-in-law, and my father-in-law are all Dominics. And we were in the same room together. I'm Dom, and I call them Dumb and Dumber. So that's how we get through that with them. Her last name and my mother's maiden name is the same also. So I'm pretty sure I might be related to my wife somewhere down the road. I can't figure it out.
Well, Dominic, thank you so much for coming on with us here. I know it's probably been a wild last year or so at this point for you, but are things starting to finally die down now that it's been about a month or so since the finale, maybe closer to a month and a half at this point since the finale has been over?
Yeah, it has, and it's been refreshing that it's died down. There's actually days I wake up and not think Survivor as soon as I get up out of bed, which was not the case for a good year and change, you know, even in the preparation for the game, waiting for the call to know if I made it on the show. I mean, basically since October of 2016, like as soon as you get that first call, all you're thinking is, am I going to be on? What do I got to do next? What's my next step? How do I get there? And then the waiting period between filming and then it airing is crazy. And then the 13 weeks that the show is on the air, all these different pieces or all these different stages to the experience that I can't even describe it. It's these little layers of starting with a phone call, getting a call to go to LA for finals, waiting for that moment to see if you made it to the show, getting on the show, doing the show, waiting, watching it air, and then all the feedback that spills out afterwards. The whole thing is, it's not, you can't compare it to anything. It's just so overwhelming. And then one day, it's all over. And it's like, it never even happened. It's crazy. It's really crazy.
And I'm sure it's hard to fully get it off your mind, but you seem like the type to deal with that by just burying yourself in family and work and just keeping yourself busy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We have some house projects going on right now, so we're busy with that. The kids keep me cranking all the time, and my job is really demanding as well. So, you know, I don't really have time to sit there and think about it as much as I used to, which is good because I need a mental break from all of it. Not to the point where I don't want to ever talk about it again, but it's refreshing to go through even a good part of the day not thinking about it. I think all of the contestants will agree with that. Like, as fun as it is and as much as we love it, and any one of us would love to go back on and play tomorrow, but I believe there's something healthy about taking yourself out of that element after being in it for so long, because it just really takes a toll on your mind.
When you get back from filming a season of Survivor, how long does that feeling of like being grateful for like the food you have and so forth last? Like, does that wear off very quickly, or is that something that still it hits you at the Survivor experience impacting your regular life?
I think that affects everybody differently. And the reason why I say that, and not to say that the whole like coming home and eating what I want, I'll tell you about that in a second. But you got to remember, my ending to my game was it was pretty dramatic for me. And to be honest with you, like, food wasn't even on my mind when I got home. Like, yeah, I did eat what I wanted to, but it's not like I didn't get to like say, oh, I've been waiting to have this slice of pizza, or I've been waiting to have Shake Shack, or like I'm sitting there still processing the fact that I just, like, you got to remember, I knew the result in that moment. So for me, I'm processing the fact that I lost this game by one vote. And that to me was the process that I needed to really get through. But then again, I do recall like working in Brooklyn and then like passing this deli I used to go to all the time. And I remember like going in there, like maybe a week after I was home, and just like ordering like two of everything. And it was obnoxious. I ended up giving away half the food, but it was just because I remember thinking when I was in Fiji, I can't wait to get home and try that sandwich again. I miss that sandwich that I've had 100 times and now I don't have it anymore. And but yeah, it does wear off pretty quick because the weight starts coming back for me anyway. A lot of these contestants still look immaculate and they didn't miss a beat. They went right back into their fitness regimen. And you know, for the most part I did too, CrossFit, but I thought it was necessary to reward myself, which is not a great mentality. So I did kind of eat what I wanted to for a much longer period of time than I promised myself I would. And maybe it was a subliminal like thought, like I earned it, you know, like I just played this kick-ass game and I earned the right to eat ice cream 3 nights a week with my kids. Whatever it was, I don't know. But I really, my mentality I told myself when I was going to come home from the game was don't binge. Don't do that. You have a lot of weight off right now. And for me, that's a sensitive thing because I put weight on really quick and I used to be really heavy back in the day. So for me to still stay in like the 200-pound range is a huge accomplishment. And I really don't want to like let that go out of bounds. And it kind of, even now, I'm probably around 210, which is not great for me. So I'm currently in the process of working on that right now. But I don't know. I go off on these tangents. But ultimately, the food thing is something you look forward to while you're there. And then when you get home, you enjoy it. But I think I would say it wears away pretty quick.
Yeah. If you're happy talking about that, can you get into that weight loss process and what that meant for you? Because I know that was one of the things that was flagged up as this this personal transformation in a lot of your like pre-game press and so on, but it was never really alluded to on the show, and we didn't get a sense of like what that actually meant on a personal level. So if you're happy to, can you take us through that quickly?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that happened overnight, you know. I mean, I tell it like it happened overnight, like the day my daughter was born, I changed my outlook on life. But in my 20s, it's not like I wasn't a criminal. I wasn't into mischief. I didn't make great decisions. And I don't even mean to say that like I was a terrible person. Like I just, instead of, you know, if I had work the next day when I should go home and get a good night's sleep, I'd stay out till, you know, 1 in the morning with the boys watching the game at the bar. You know, things like that. And when you do that night after night or whatever it is, or, you know, I was not a complete degenerate gambler. I did like to bet games a lot. I did like to hit the casino a lot, and not in a responsible way, where now I can say I'll play poker, but I do it responsibly. I make sure the budget is intact. I saved for it. I'll go out. I'll play a tournament. If I lose it, no skin off my back. Not a big deal, because to me, I can't see throwing money away now when I have 3 kids at home. To me, that's like, it's the most irresponsible and disgusting thing someone can do. But again, it doesn't mean I can't still have fun. It doesn't mean I can't still go out with my friends and have a drink with them. It's just the way in which we do it now is more, it's just a more responsible way to do it. I used to drink and drive. You know, another thing I'm not very proud of. I would never, ever let anybody do that. You know, if I'm out with you guys and, you know, I see someone's got their keys and they're hitting the bottle or whatever, like I go out of my way to make sure I'll drive you home. I'll pay for your Uber, whatever it is. And again, this is all because of, you know, experiences in my 20s where I just like either had bad experiences myself or had friends who had bad experiences and maybe died or whatever it may be. So whatever it was, you know, I kept telling myself, all right, I can't keep going down this path. I can't keep going down this path. And then, like I said, I had my first daughter, And when I had her, I realized, like, wow, I'm a dad now. Like, this is serious. I got to start to take this seriously now. And even that wasn't overnight. I think maybe it was like by the time she was one or even two. And it was just when she started walking. And I remember, like, we were in the backyard and we were playing. And, like, I was huffing and puffing running around my backyard with my daughter. And I'm like, no way. And I was like 31. Early 2008. I'm 30. Yeah. Around 31. I mean, there's no way I should be huffing and puffing at 31, 32 years old, whatever I was. So I don't know. I just opened my eyes to it and I realized that something has to change. And so I started with, like, running a lot and dieting, but then I'd still go out and drink on weekends. And I'd find that by drinking on weekends come Monday, that whole diet regimen would go right out the window. So I had to actually, like, carve a few different poor habits of mine so that, in other words, I can't just fix one problem. I have to fix the whole problem for it to be corrected. And it did. It came down to, like, me saying no to a lot of my friends, which sucked because I love my boys. You know, we have a great time when we go out. And just eating better, making better decisions with food, and just being active for the first time in my life. And now, you know, for the first time, I started running long distance. I was running like 6-7 miles and started hitting the weights a little bit. And it just got, like, over the years, over the last 4 or 5 years, it kind of got, like, it's rewarding because I feel better, I look better. But it's like, how much running do I want to do and go to the gym with all, like, these young bucks who are all staring at themselves in the mirror and they're all juiced out. And it's like, it just wasn't doing it for me. And then it wasn't until about maybe 2 years ago, a good friend of ours, it's actually where Kristen is right now in PA, our friend Elaney and Scott, they owned a CrossFit gym. And we were visiting them and they were like, come on down to the CrossFit gym. You know, it's, you know, you don't have to pay. It's our gym. You'll just jump into class or whatever. And I don't know what it was that magnetized me to it. And again, I'm not – I have a problem with people that just won't stop talking about CrossFit, so I'm not going to be that guy. Like, it's not a religion. It's just a way of life for some people. And for me, the biggest thing for me is that I think it filled in that gap that I used to get, you know, through my bad habits in a weird way. And it doesn't make sense, but there's this adrenaline that I'm always chasing, you know. And whether, you know, and anyone that's gambled knows what I'm talking about, especially if you play poker and you're bluffing a huge pot and you're just, your heart's beating through your chest and you're waiting to see if the guy's going to call you or not. It's this adrenaline rush that I've always been chasing. And I don't know why, but something about CrossFit that gets my adrenaline going again. And I don't know if it is because we do these wads and it's like this workout that we all do at the same time and there's a countdown clock. And I know, I remember feeling in Survivor, like, anytime, like, we'd get ready to do a challenge, it reminded me of the countdown clock at CrossFit counting down from 10 to 0 because it was that same, like, juices flowing feeling I'd have in my body where I was like, this is happening. Like, I have to perform in the next few seconds and I better be ready to do it. And there's a high about that to me. And it's something that I'm so happy I found because it's finally filling that void that I have from not doing the things I used to do. And it's, luckily it's positive. It's a good thing. I'm not burning my bank account. I'm not hurting my children. I'm not hurting people out in the street. I'm just doing something good for myself, good for my family. And it's been great. And even if I do step out of line a little bit with my eating habits or I fall off the wagon, which, you know, it's going to happen because I enjoy life too much to be that strict. You know what I mean? And my fan, Kristen's the same way. Like, we both work our ass off to be fit, but I know some people will, you know, look down on this comment, but for me, it's like, I want to live life. And if that means I'm going to try certain foods or drink certain beverages, and I'm not talking about soda and eating Big Macs, that's irresponsible. But, you know, even if Monday through Friday I put it into full gear and I eat super clean and I work out 5 days during the week, on weekends that's my time to unload and just, and again, it's not like I'm going bananas on weekends, but I'm going to allow myself these certain things. And I found that that's the best balance for me in life, you know, like, as long as I can commit to Monday through Friday and even Saturday, Sunday, I still work out occasionally and whatever it may be. But I really try to dedicate the weekends to my kids. And like I said, we do family stuff. We hang out with our friends and the kids and the neighbors, and we'll barbecue or whatever it is. And that's my time to just do what I want and have a few extras that I don't really treat myself to during the week. And to me, between the CrossFit and just that mentality on how I eat and my diet, that's to me the right way to do it. But like I said, I'm on the upswing right now because the last few weekends have been really nice out and we've been going a little overboard with the eating and the drinking. But hey, it's the summer, right? Got to enjoy yourself.
So this is the real test, right? The next few weeks to see if you can keep it on the level. But that's interesting because you see a lot of people who they decide they want to overhaul some aspect of their life and they just dive right in and they go just full force at it. And it goes from being an unhealthy relationship in one direction to an unhealthy relationship maybe in the other direction where they're not allowing themselves any slack whatsoever. And often they burn out on that commitment pretty quickly because they find they can't adjust to that radical change. But it sounds like you were able to kind of do everything in moderation and work things through in a way to where you have achieved that balance. You're able to keep that going.
Well, yeah, but that's why I failed so many times in the last 8-9 years because I was so extreme. And it took failing over and over and over again to realize, like, if I go that far with it, I'm never going to accomplish success in this. You know what I mean? So you're right. Like, you can't be super extreme. You can have super extreme moments. Like, in other words, and again, I'm not going to go on this whole nutrition thing, but, like, I'm really into, like, the ketogenic diet right now and intermittent fasting. These are two topics that, like, really intrigue me, not even from a weight loss standpoint, but from, like, a longevity. There's all these studies coming out how it's like, you know, an extended 7-day fast 2 or 3 times a year can like clear out all the precancer cells in your body. I don't know. I don't want to get into that. But what I'm saying is balance is critical and it's fine to self-experiment occasionally throughout the year. You know what I'm saying? So for me, like you said, hitting one extreme or the other is what's it's never going to work for me. I need to find that balance.
With the weight loss in particular, did you find that the way that you felt about yourself and other people and how they treated you changed from how you were before to how you were after?
Yeah, it's a combination of the change in body type and age. And what I mean by that is when I first did drop the weight and I was hitting the gym, I started looking good. And I went from being kind of humble to a little bit arrogant even when I first dropped the weight and was lifting and my muscles were showing for the first time. And not that I was really arrogant, like I was so much better than other people, but let's just say for the first time I was really confident and I was obnoxious a little bit because I found something that worked for me and I thought it was my job to preach to the world on how to get fit. And that's just not the way to, like, people are going to do what works for them. And it's not my job to educate the world on my diet and what makes me feel good. And that's what I'm saying. So the whole process from failing my diet or whatever it may be, in addition to the actual exercise and the eating component, was this whole other element where I thought I was the smartest person in the world and I knew everything about certain foods to eat and complex carbs and this and that and all this. And I realized, like, what an idiot I sound like. Just shut up. Do what works for you. Find the balance. Let people do what works for them. If someone is interested in what you're doing, then feel free to speak to them. Let them ask you questions and answer them. But don't go out and try to educate the world because what works for you doesn't necessarily work for everybody. And nobody cares. And nobody wants to hear you. Some person sit there and spew, you know, knowledge out that, you know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. Who am I to sit here and talk nutrition with people? But anyway.
Yeah. Going back to the weight loss and the survivor time quickly, for a lot of people, that's just a quirk of that experience. They go on the show, they're not eating properly for a month, so they lose a bunch of weight, and then they go for their weigh-in, they've lost 20 pounds, and then they go to Ponderosa and put most of that back on again pretty quick. But for most of them, that's just a footnote in the overall experience. Whereas for you, I imagine, given your history with that, that maybe took on a different significance.
Hey, you know what's funny too is that they didn't show this on the show, but they actually gave us a mirror myself, Wendell, and Laurel, final three, as we were walking to get the food for the final three breakfast feast, on the way, they had a scale and a mirror, and they were like, you know, they did this whole thing. And I thought they were going to show that, because we were baffled by the way we looked. I remember looking at myself in the mirror that morning and just, I could not believe what I looked like. Mm-hmm. And it was, it astonished me to the biggest reason why it took me by surprise was I couldn't believe how much I looked like my father. And I mean that, like, in the fact that I looked old. I was all gray, you know, my whole beard was gray and the sides of my hair was gray. And I always had a little bit of gray, but I could not believe how gray I was. And now that I'm home, I'm gray all the time. It's like I let it come in, I shaved it, and now all that wants to come back into my life is gray.
Well, you're like Obama. It's like Survivor takes a toll on people. Like,
exactly.
It looks like you,
yeah. It was the presidency in 39 days. That's exactly what it was. Yep. Yeah. Every president that goes in brown comes out white or gray. You're right.
At least you won the Electoral College. You have that going for you.
It sounds like you have had many different kind of phases to not just your life, but it seems like your adult life. You've been through a lot of different versions of yourself almost. But I know that you're someone who's watched the show for a long time and was applying to the show for a long time. In retrospect, are you happy at having had all this play out with the point in your life that you were cast for Survivor, or do you wish that that had happened sooner, or that maybe, you know, if the spot was guaranteed, maybe you could have waited another year or two if you knew it could happen, or where do you land on that?
I think life experience helps you in this game. There's no question about it. There's a flip side to that coin, though, because I remember feeling like the old guy on day one and feeling a little bit like an outcast early in the game. I remember there was a lot of conversations going on about topics I've never heard of, you know, and I was like, how do I get myself into this conversation? So it was really an uncomfortable feeling in the beginning for me.
Are you the Rapper guy or a Kanye guy?
See, I heard of Kanye, right? But I've never heard of Chance the Rapper. Right. OK. And this is what the majority of these conversations were about sometimes, just about like hip things that's trendy and, you know, the 20 something year olds generation that's going on. And I'm like, I'm almost 40. I don't know what they're talking about.
Well look, Colin's getting older, but I'm hip. I'm young. I can explain the youth of today to you if it comes to that.
Chance the Rapper, by the way. That's who you're a guy for, just in case anyone asks in the future.
What I've heard is he's a much better person in life. So that's I'm for that. I'm for that. But I'd say once I got my footing and I felt a little more comfortable with some of the people in the game and on my team, I'd say at that point, that's when life experience kicked in, because now I've had multiple conversations with these people and now I'm able to start to read them, and I'm starting to be able to know their signs and their tells, and now I can kind of like hone in on them. And that, to me, I was happy to not be young and maybe a little bit blind to certain things. I don't think I would have played as creative of a game if I would have went, you know, 10 years ago. You know, I really tried to bring a level of creativity to the game. I know I've said that. I meant it, though. And what I mean by that is, like, any time there was really like a down moment, I was always trying to figure out a way to like really utilize that downtime as an opportunity to make something, if not immediately happen, maybe make something down the road happen. And I was just trying to like manipulate these, just any situation that would come up. Obviously you don't want to do too much, so you'd have to sit back and lay back a little bit. But for me, I just really wanted to figure out a creative way to utilize any opportunity that came to me. And again, I think age really had a big part in that.
I'm a little surprised by that creativity point, because from what you said before, you would think when you were in your 20s, you were more of a risk taker, less cautious, not really considering maybe the future impact of what you were doing. It seems like that type of player is more likely to be making these crazy moves and coming out with these weird ideas. But you're saying that with the benefit of experience, you're maybe more able to do that in a responsible way. I'm not sure.
Well, because in my 20s, I was too spontaneous. I would just say I want to do something and I'd do it. And that didn't give me the opportunity to get creative. It just would have, it would have put me in a situation where I would have reacted, because I'm too impatient and I am too big of a risk taker, and I would have just acted on something and said, screw it, I'll pay the consequences later. The same way I used to walk into a casino and put $500 down on black and say, whatever the consequences are, they are what they are. You know what I mean? So that was me in my 20s, where I wouldn't have sat back and thought about a situation and figured out a creative way to either get out of it or use it to my benefit later in the game. And again, a lot of that, I know that whole Chris fake idol with the shell, as ridiculous as it seemed, that to me was me sitting back and trying to figure out a way to get out of this pickle I'm in with this guy. It came off pretty outlandish, but in my mind at the time, it made sense. And I'll act on something if it makes sense to me, as long as I think it through multiple times and try to see, if this goes bad, what happens there? And if that goes bad, what happens there? And to me, I played all the different scenarios out in my head with him in that whole shell game. But ultimately, like I said, that having those moments to figure out a creative way to get out of this situation with Chris was something I really tried to do throughout the game. And sometimes it backfired and sometimes it didn't.
In light of that idea about your perspective changing with age, it has to be bizarre to go out there and meet Michael Yerger, who at the tender age of 18 already seems to be like this fully actualized self.
Yeah, and I didn't know what to think of him, because I didn't spend any time with him up until the merge. So I finally met him at the merge, and I definitely knew he was young, but he was so mature and so well-spoken. So when he said he was 23, I was actually surprised at that number. I would have bought 25. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of it had to do with the way he spoke. If he would have come off, hey, dude, what's up? I'd be like, this kid's 18, you know, but he didn't. He made sure that he really crafted his language in a way that had us convinced that he was mature, definitely experienced in life and, you know, things of that nature. And he was able to talk about real estate in certain ways. But I'd say after a week or so of chat with him, I did start to see some things creep out of him that showed that he was younger than 23. I can't really think of examples. It was really just the way he was passionate about talking about something that like young people are into. I think that was like my one tell, where I'm like, this kid, he seems a little young all of a sudden.
He's not as cynical and jaded as the rest of us are with age.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like you were, grateful to some extent that you had some more life experience under your belt when you were out there. And I think everyone I've ever heard talk about Michael talked about just what a frankly fantastic job he seemed to do on all cards during his season. Do you think that Michael would have been better off too, getting some more life experience under his belt? Or do you think that potentially it could vary from person to person as far as the optimal time or point in their life for them to be playing Survivor?
Well, yeah, that's definitely the case. Not everybody is the same. For me, life experience was a requirement to play this game, because I didn't have a good head on my shoulders at Michael Yerger's age. And he happens to have a very good head on his shoulders. And he knows, you know, he knows good decision making, for as far as I know, you know, unless he has me fooled still. But I could tell. You could just tell there's a huge difference in me at 18 and Michael Yerger at 18. I think Michael Yerger at 18 and me at 18 would have had a good time together, though.
I would pay so much money to make sure that footage of 18-year-old me never makes it onto television. There's no way. Yeah. I would be okay with that.
Yeah, I'm totally in agreement with that. Yeah,
I think there's a danger with this question of romanticizing those past negative experiences. But do you feel there's some benefit of having gone through those and maybe exploring your own kind of character flaws and having to work through those in terms of knowing what your limits are and knowing how to kind of handle challenges? Because for someone Michael's age, who already seems very composed, you can imagine the vast majority of the time he just succeeds at whatever he wants to, but then maybe when he runs up against those obstacles, he isn't as well equipped to handle those.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you can apply this to Survivor, you could apply it to life. I mean, there's no question. Even Michael will be the first to tell you he needs more life experience. he'll be the first to tell you he needs to do more things, but I'm pretty sure he's doing them. You know what I mean? He's doing his thing. And for me, like I said, you know, it's an individual thing where one person may need, another person may not. And I just think the whole thing, the whole process of going through life is all about learning about yourself and knowing what your limitations are and how far can you push yourself and this and that. And then being ready for a specific challenge, because you may have gone through something similar to it in your earlier years. Right. That's obviously going to be more beneficial for me than it is to someone like Michael. But it's not to say that Michael won't have the ability to embrace difficulties better than I did, possibly. You know what I mean? Let's say he hits a bump in the road. He seems to me like he has a better sense of he's just more well-rounded, where he can face a challenge and be able to work through it, maybe in a non or a less reckless way that I may have in my at his age when I was, you know. So I don't know. It's a real individual thing. A lot of it has to do with how you're raised, and your environment. You know, growing up, who your friends were growing up. That's a huge thing for me, because my friends like. I love them to death. These guys back in the day, I would have laid in traffic for my friends. You know, I would have taken a bat to anyone's head that they told me to. This is like the brotherhood that we had. As great as it is, I had to like not say goodbye to it completely, but I really had to detach myself. But and you know what? A lot of these guys are married with kids too now, so it doesn't really matter. And there's always this bond that we have with each other, but there's these moments you have that you just can't. Yeah, it's a whole thing, but it's individual for me. My life experience was definitely something, and I still have so much more to do to really get myself where I want to be from a mental, physical, just a life, a life goal, just to really be where I want to be financially, everything, the whole package is I think it's what everyone strives for, is to really just have a real well-rounded, sense of everything. And to me, one of the biggest things for me that I learned and one of the biggest transformations for me was learning to be open-minded. You know, my parents I kind of grew up in I'd say conservative. You know, my father, we didn't really talk politics much. My dad recently got on this conservative bandwagon and whatever. It's his thing. It's fine. But to me, I go out of my way to create a scenario that avoids an us versus them mentality, if that makes sense. Personally, what I learned in life over the last many years was that I go out of my way to hear anybody out, and I don't judge anybody on race, religion, sex, anything. I have a conversation with you, and after that conversation, I either like you or I don't like you.
With that mentality, then, how do you kind of identify the people who are not worth your time, maybe are full of shit, and who are not going to be positive additions to your life, versus the ones who maybe they don't make a good first impression, but when you dig beneath the surface, there's something valuable there?
To me, I appreciate more than anything if you're direct with me. For example, I was saying how much I would love to hang out with Bradley more. I wish he lived closer. And even Chris Noble, who I do see a lot, we do live close. These are like examples that you guys can kind of relate to, because you know who I'm talking about. And what it is for me is I prefer to speak to people who say it how it is and don't feed me a line of bullshit. And if I don't agree with what you're saying, that's fine. Just be open-minded to have the discussion. And you may change my mind and I may change yours, or we may not change each other's. But when the conversation's over, we have to be able to smile, shake each other's hand, and say, I respect your opinion. That's fine. We're still friends. You know what I mean? To me, that's like the essence of communication in the world. And that's what I try to engage more of in, is that I try to avoid people who just preach their way or the highway. And if you don't follow their code, you're not in their circle. I don't have time for you. I don't have time for that.
Well, it sounds like that can be hard to maintain at times. So with your survivor experience, for instance, you're dealing with a bunch of very different personalities. So in your own alliance, you have Wendell, who maybe is more of a background figure than you were at times. And then the sense I get with Laurel is she is quite reserved, or she's not just going to be like barking orders at people, right? She's going to be just a kind of more measured, thoughtful person. So you kind of have to differentiate between the people who are indirect because they're hiding something and are trying to keep stuff from you versus the ones who maybe are just in their shell and need a little bit of gentle coaxing to come out of that.
Yeah, and you know, Survivor's not exactly like life. Obviously, I'm going to receive these people differently than I would the average person on the street, because I know I'm in a game and I know I have to sculpt my personality around theirs and do this and that. But you're right. It gives you the casting process is the casting process for a reason, because it's important that they make sure that they have the most mixed, diverse group of people that will create these scenarios that are uncomfortable, you know? And it really is up to the player to really determine each individual person that they come in contact with and their, you know, their personality and their behavior and how they're going to react to something you say. And again, it's you can think you have a handle on it, but I'm the first person to tell you, as good as you think you are, you're not that good, you know, because to this day, the fact that, Kellen and Sebastian, and again, I know the whole final six thing went down the way it was, but I think I heard Sebastian say in his exit interview at the finale, like, he hated me the whole time. I mean, I don't even know where that came from. I was the first person he picked on the family loved one reward. If he hated me, why did he pick me for that? And I remember having...
We don't need to go too deep into the mysteries of Sebastian's mind necessarily. But I know you said in your talk with Rob that you were surprised when you were called out as being coming off as brash or arrogant, because to you, it's almost the opposite. It's being humble, it's being direct with people and not trying to beat around the bush or try to get one over on them. And I guess, is that just a product of upbringing, where I know you said that you were raised in what Aubrey Bracco would call a large Italian family, and in your case, a very large Italian family. And I guess you have to speak loudly and directly in order to get a word in edgeways.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And that's how I feel I want to be spoken to. But again, you can't necessarily speak to people the way you want to be spoken to in the game, you know, and that's the one thing I missed when I was out there, that I thought certain people would respect the way I'm speaking to them, because I'm not beating around the bush and I may be delivering a message in a way that's giving them their answer right away instead of, you know, holding your hand through the process, you know, like, oh yeah, maybe that's what's going, you know, I don't know. It's like, for me, I prefer to get to the point. And the fact that I was unaware of my, I don't know, I guess what I was giving off, it struck me. It really struck me. I was surprised, because when I was out there, I really felt like I went out of my way to make sure everybody was comfortable at all times. I really made sure that if you did have an issue with me, that we talked it out. I don't ever recall a time where I ever had a conversation and said, get away from me, I'm done talking to you. Those words would never come out of my mouth. I always offered an olive branch if we were in a dispute. I always offered an opportunity to have a discussion in a strategic sense, but also on a personal level. I don't want someone who feels a certain way towards me to feel that way towards me if it's negative. And if there is a negative thing that I'm giving off, I want to correct it, because I want to find out the root of the problem, because if I do it in my real life, I want to make sure I correct it in my real life as well. So that's why I think I even had conversations with Kellen, and I said, Kellen, if there is something I'm doing, let's talk about it. And I recall we did have a conversation. I'm not going to get into it, but she did say, Dom, you do this, you do that, you do this, and you know, maybe you need to recognize it more. And I told her, I said, I appreciate you telling me. I said, I'm not, you know, if I am doing it in my real life, I want to know it. So let me make sure that I am aware of it and I can see it. Now, whether I was really that person, or maybe that was just the way she or some of the people perceived me, who knows? What's the answer? Is it that I was brash, or is it just that certain people may have different sensitivity levels to a way somebody communicates with them? And who makes it right? Who makes it wrong? Who's to say what's right and wrong? It sometimes it's not a matter of being right and wrong. It's just an unfortunate situation for the person who needs that person's vote. You can't get their love no matter how many times you try, no matter how many things you say. You just can't get that person to perceive it the way you want them to. And this is the thing this is the thing that even more than not winning the game really had me bummed out, you know, that no matter how many attempts I may have made to hear really negative remarks about me, that I was bully-like and that I was just really mean towards people, like that's – I don't have that in my soul. To this day, I don't have that in my soul. But – that doesn't mean I wasn't that way to those people in their minds. And that doesn't make them wrong is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. One of, I thought, your most kind of observant quotes that you gave in your interview with Rob was talking, I think it was about either Final Tribal Council or the Final Six Tribal Council, talking about how, look, if that's their perception of me, then that's their perception of me. And I can't really call that wrong. That is the way they came across. And I think, you know, in order to overcome that, not just if you were to go back on Survivor, but just improve in life, I think it requires that kind of self-reflective kind of approach. And I do think that is just not just, again, not just on Survivor or in life, but in any game, in a game like poker or whatever else, that is the way that one goes about enacting like a positive change. So it is really good to hear you coming at it from that perspective.
Yeah, and I agree 100% with that. So, and again, I'm not sitting here preaching that I was not at fault. You know, perhaps right. I was. And that's where my adjustment needs to be made. Like I said, not only in the game, but in life, because perhaps I do rub people the wrong way and I don't even realize it. You know what I mean? So I'm really, since the game, I've really been trying to be more aware of how I do speak to people. Again, I'm not going to not be me. You know, I love who I am. I like being direct with people. But I just keep an eye out on things. And if I feel like someone in a conversation maybe got rubbed the wrong way, I won't let it slide. You know what I mean? I'll go back and readdress it. And I'll say, look, mm-hmm. did that come off the wrong way? Because if it did, I just want you to know is really what I meant. And I really haven't had a confrontation like that, you know. But I know that that's something I do try to recognize now. And I do want to correct in life, you know. And as far as the game goes, I don't really think – I feel like I put my best effort in to correct those mistakes with the people out there. You know what I mean? I did realize that there was an issue with the way I was communicating with people. And it's not like I ignored it. I did address the situation. Now, if me addressing the situation didn't correct the problem and ended up costing me the game, then so be it. But I feel like I can sit here and, you know, my head held high and say I at least put the effort in. I know I made the attempt. And I don't feel like – I think at the end of the day when the game is over, I can sit here and say that I think I played a respectful game. Even if I had moments that came off in a certain light, I know that I went out of my way to try to apologize or at least explain why I spoke a certain way that I did, and especially talking about the Final Six thing. The Final Six thing was an act from start to finish, and it had nothing to do with me trying to beat on anybody or anything like that. And I think the combination of Wendell jumping in the mix really made the situation way worse than it was. And again, not to get into details with it, but that was a situation that when I left that tribal, I really was like, man, I have to correct this mistake because I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish in pulling off this bluff. But in the process, I did a lot of damage. And I knew I had a moment to reiterate the whole thing at Final Tribal. And I think I made headway with my explanation, whether they showed it on the show or not, I don't remember. But I think I did make some headway, and I did have people nodding, yes, you're right, I understand now. but I don't think it made an impact enough where it changed anyone's mind on who they're going to vote for.
If you had the opportunity to do that again, knowing what you know now about the way it was received by the jury, what kind of major things would you do differently with how you approached that final six situation?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Like, how could I have still sold it without being so harsh? And you know, the only reason why I came in guns blazing was really because Donathan was pretty feisty in several tribals leading up to it. And to me, in my mind, I thought about the process right before we went to tribal that night. I said, I think I might have to do this because Angela spilled the beans about this big plan that Sebastian's going to do. And now it's up to me to figure out a way to get out of it while salvaging my idol. And in my mind, it was, all right, how can I get this so that I have a reason to break two idols out? Like, is there really a reason why I'd ever break two idols out? I said, the only way I can break two idols out is if I create this environment where the opposing team, being Sebastian and Donathan, feel like they have to play defense against me. And now I have to in turn play defense against them. So if I'm on defense, I'm going to break out my defensive weapons and say, this is why I'm not going home. So come up with a new game plan. So when I went into tribal, I really was going out of my way to stir the pot so that we can have a back and forth argument, which will give me an opportunity to break out these two idols and say, well, your plan's not going to work. It backfired in the fact that nobody came out with guns blazing except for me. Nobody came to fight. It was basically like Donathan was sitting there like a broken puppy who was like, I guess I'm going home. And I'm like, no, this is not the reaction I wanted. I need you to fight with me right now so that I could sell the story. And he decided not to fight with me. And he did for every other tribal. You saw he gave me shit. And Sebastian didn't say a word either. He basically admitted his guilt to this plan. And now it was really up to me. And I think I mentioned this with Rob, was I had to sell not only to change Sebastian and Donathan's mind on who to vote for, but I really needed to make sure that I drove the point so that no one would really ask Probst to validate my idol. And that's a real critical part that no one takes into consideration because, you know, I didn't see Ben with season 35 when he played an idol prior to the vote and where Jeff actually did say, you know, this is a real idol. And now I didn't know what was going to happen if I did this. I didn't know. I said, worst case scenario, if it goes bad and he blows my spot up, I can always play my real idol. I said, but I'm going to gamble. I'm going to hope he doesn't blow my spot up. And as long as nobody asks Jeff to validate it, I think I'm good. And that's why the whole story went down as harshly as it did on television. And in the moment, it was rough. Like I said, if Wendell stayed out of it, I think it would have been less aggressive. I mean, they'll still say it was aggressive, but I think it would have been less aggressive. And I was really trying to accomplish those two goals of convincing Sebastian to not play his extra vote on me and play a vote for somebody else and to make sure that no one at Final Tribal is going to ask Jeff to validate my idol. And that's what I accomplished. You know what I mean? I accomplished that. But in the process, there was a lot of damage in the aftermath.
You were someone who, over the course of this season, had a lot in your bag of tricks where you had the real idol, the initial fake idol, the eventual David Wright fake idol, and also the legacy advantage. I heard an interesting stat the other day, actually, that in the last four seasons of Survivor, there have been 28 hidden immunity idols. What is your take on the general kind of influx of idols and advantages in the more recent seasons of Survivor?
I think for a player like me, I love it. I do understand the reasoning. I understand how it takes the natural game out of it a little bit, the social, pure social aspect out of it a little bit. When you do have these devices you can break out, I understand that. But for me, if you're going to ask me which side of the table I sit on, it's definitely I'm for it. I'm not for an overabundance of it, but for the right amount. And as long as in one given moment, there's not more than a certain set number in play, I think that guideline is fine. I think, you know, if there's three tribes in the moment. Three idols are allowed in play, but not a thing more. The problem is you don't want to go to a final six scenario with three people having idols, because it's for the players who put their heart into their social game. This could be a moment where they get burnt over something like three idols getting played, like Suri, you know, the whole thing with Game Changers. And it is unfortunate, but if how I look at it is, if you want to play Survivor, you can play Survivor as long as you agree to all of the rules. And all of the rules state that this game is a social game. You know, it's a physical game. It's a mental game. And there are these little tricks and trinkets sitting out on the island. And now you can focus your game purely on the social aspect, but that means you have a hole in your ability to find these artifacts. And I think the complete Survivor player is able to either A, find something or create something, an artifact, and have a good balance of social game, physical ability, mental awareness, strategic. To me, the perfect player has the whole package. So while I get that it takes away from the purity of the earlier seasons, where the beginning seasons was, you know, I have no problem with them doing that one or two seasons again. I don't know. I think people's attention spans these days require all these artifacts in the game, because we need to see something crazy and dramatic happen. And sometimes, you know, five episodes in a row of pure social game and really no tricks being played, it might get a little redundant and a little boring, and people might I have a feeling the game will turn into constant pagongings over and over and over again, where it's just like, you got this group of people, they're just going to take out that group of people, and that's it. This gives that underdog team the ability to break free from being underdogs. And to me, I think the whole package is what makes a great player. I mean, if you want to put a number or a limit on the amount of artifacts in the game, I'm fine with that. You want to reduce the number of it, I'm fine with that. But I think there always needs to be a wild card in the deck, where you just never know if someone's going to have something or break something out, or better yet, someone like Chris Noble who has it and doesn't even play it. I mean, that is fantastic. To me, that's great. And I think it gives the audience the ability to stay on their toes as well. Or at least it gives, you know, the editing team the ability to keep, you know, the viewers on their toes, because there are these little wild cards in the game where you're not really sure if someone's going to break something out or not. And for me, I do support idols and advantages. Maybe I do also support the concept of reducing the number of them.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are probably on board with that. It's, again, it goes back to the idea of finding, like, the middle ground is really where you want to be in this situation. Some, but not an insane number. But quickly, I'm curious, when you think through some of the most complete players and what all of the strengths that they have, what names come to mind for you as someone who's seen at least most of the seasons of Survivor, or at least a solid number of Survivor seasons? Who would you consider some of the best players of all time?
You got to really have that balance, you know, you got to have that balance. And I'm trying to think, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be a winner, right? I mean, it could just be someone who kind of had the whole package. And it sounds silly. I say, if you take the beginning of his game out of it, and the other reason why I say David Wright is because I kind of felt like him a little bit in the game, but I think he had a real sense of creativity. I think he played a really good social game. I would say he wasn't physical, but I'm pretty sure he won a few immunity challenges. Also, Jeremy, what a perfect balance of finding idols, social game, physical ability. Even Tyson's season that he won, I think, is the same thing. I'd say Jeremy's up there. And yeah. I tell you what, you could throw Wendell in that mix right now as well. From a physical standpoint, strategic, social, ability to find and create artifacts in the game. I mean, that to me, I'd say those three or four players right there to me stand out. I'm sure there's a solid 10 more people. If I could just run through it, you know, I could give you more names. But just off the top of my head, those few players right there that have all those components wrapped into their game, that's where you really see the complete player.
So for you, when you were preparing to go out there, were there any players that you were trying to model yourself after, or any particular seasons or incidents or anything like that that you kind of noted down as things to learn from?
Well, it's weird. You know, we're asked that question in the preseason, like who are you going to emulate your game at? Like, it's like, I want to be me out there. You know, I'm not going to try to be somebody, but there are obviously aspects of people's games that you want to try to piece together, you know, and like you could talk about Ceree's social game and, you know, you see how Ceree was kind of like the older woman of the bunch, and she still figured out a way to like hang out with the 20 somethings and get them to feel like, you know, she's Aunt Ceree. You can talk to her about anything. And when I went out there, I remember that was the first thing I tried to do earlier in the game with some of the youngers, like with Chelsea and Morgan. I was like, listen, just look at me as a big brother out here, all right? I just if you ever feel like you need to like shoot the shit or blow off some steam or you're missing family, you know, I want to be that person for you, all right? So just consider me a big brother. So I was trying to bring the Ceree component into the game. I did also mention the Tony aspect. Without his, you know, without the wild side of Tony, I believed he had the creative the creativity level that is required for this game. You know what I mean? With all his shenanigans, with his bag of tricks and all the things he did. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I think Tony sits in that complete player package. He did win his season. He did play a phenomenal season. But I think he lacked a little on the social side a little bit. Strategically,
he seemed to be the most common comparison for you. Did that? How did you feel about that, of Tony being that? Because he seems like to be compared to Tony, you need to be a very distinct kind of player.
I don't know. You know, I wasn't in the game with him. Maybe his social game's amazing. I don't know. But from what it came off to me as a viewer, that he was always revved up. You know what I mean? Always like charged. And like, you want to talk about adrenaline. Like, it seemed to me that Tony's game was just always like full swing, full tilt, ready to go. And to me, I think I had moments of energy like that, but I don't believe my entire game was at that full force energy level that he brought. And that's what I'd say the biggest comparison, difference in comparison is there, is that I don't think I had 24/7 energy the way he did. But yeah, I like to think from a creative standpoint, I brought a little bit of Tony into the game. I don't know how unpopular this saying Cochran, not that I in any way feel I replicate Cochran in any way, but why I say Cochran is that I remember when he played and he was with Coach, and I remember how he would just stroke Coach's ego with like the Tai Chi every morning. Like, Cochran had no desire to do Tai Chi, but he was out there every morning and he'd wear Coach's jacket and he just like, you know, he had Coach eating right out of his hand. And I made sure that I told myself that if there's any big egos out there that really need to be coddled, you know, I'll be that person's cheerleader. In the same way that Cochran was to the people he played his season with. That was another aspect that I really wanted to bring as well, because I didn't want to come off as team leader in any way. You know, I didn't want to come off as the guy who's going to run the show on my team. I wanted to let Chris Noble run the show and I'm just going to be his right-hand assistant. You know what I mean? So that was how I was. I'd say that was as close to it as I would say.
And I also think you and Cochran share a real deliberacy, if that's a word, about the approach that you both take to the game. Like, I think he really tries to think through each of his decisions the same way you described earlier, where I think you both of you really do a great job at thinking through all the various timelines and thinking through the upsides and the downsides and if the risk is going to be worth the reward and things of that nature. So I think that's a more natural comparison than it may seem on the surface.
Yeah, and that's true. And I remember one thing he said. I think it was after his season ended, where he won. How he mentioned a lot of things relied on timing. Oh, you have this situation where you have to do something, right? And there's a risk of doing that something, But on the flip side, there's also a risk of not doing something, right? And you have to look at it as evenly matched on both sides of that. And I remember Cochran kind of speaking to that, like, there may be a situation where you want to pull the trigger and do something, but you think the risk is too high in doing it. But let's look at the consequences down the road if I don't do it. And I think that remembering that about him was this one thing that really pushed me over the edge about taking Bradley out pre-merge and throwing the challenge to get him out of it, because I just thought the Survivor gods were going to crash down on me if I threw a challenge. I've seen it so many times in past seasons of Survivor where a team will throw a challenge and then they don't win another challenge for the next 7 challenges in a row. And I'm like, that's not going to be me. I'm not going to let that happen. But then I started thinking, like, all right, there's a risk of doing it, but there's also a risk of not doing it. And to me, if Bradley gets back with Kellen and Wendell after the merge, I ran all these scenarios in my head, and this is this aspect of me thinking, like, there's a risk of doing something, but there's also a risk of not doing something. And I think I recall that whole thing being a part of something that Cochran brought into the game as well. So I'd say those are the 3 players off the top of my head I could really kind of put myself in their circle. I'm sure there's different aspects of different players. Every one of us could say we're a little bit of this, we're a little bit of that. At the end of the day, I hope I can now say I'm just me. You know, I did it my way.
Yeah, I had a question about that Bradley thing quickly, because on the show, you're shown as making this big, bold move to take out Bradley. And then the next episode, it's like Bradley never existed. We're distracted by you and Chris Noble and everything else that's going on. And I was thinking, okay, well, that's a bit confusing. But then after the season, when you sit down with Rob and Kellen sits down with Rob and we get all of this extra information, we're going to get a bit more light on that. But as far as I can tell, there's still really no definitive account of what her reaction to that was, because it felt like she was still pretty close to you. And the fact that somehow Bradley left from a tribe that you were leading, and I imagine he was her closest ally at that point, it felt like that was patched over pretty quickly from what it seemed like.
Yeah, well, I gotta tell you, I was scared, because I did know that Kellen was kind of, I was gonna see Kellen at the merge, and you don't even see how significant their relationship is in the show. It was 100 times more of a bond, and you gotta remember, right, but in the show, it wasn't really there. And again, you got to remember, I didn't spend that many days with them, because I was only with both of them for the first 6 days before the first swap. But in those first 6 days, there's no question about it that those two were ride or dies. They slept next to each other every night. They talked to each other more than anyone else talked to each other. They really had a real good handle on the game, and It scared me. It scared me. I don't know what it reminded me of, but it reminded me of something that I was like, this doesn't end well for me. And it's like, in life, you may not be able to do something about it, you know, but in a game, we're all on equal playing field and I can do something about it, you know? And I said to I have really had to work myself up to follow through with pulling this off where I'm going to throw this challenge. And when I finally did it and all that went down, I now had the burden of worrying what Kellen's reaction was going to be. And I recall when I told her, I said to her, I said, Kellen, look, I know Bradley's your boy. I said, but he was running crazy over here. These last few days, he was driving everybody nuts. I said, I caught him looking in my bag. I said, nobody trusted him. He was I played him up so much worse than he really was, so that Kellen could at least feel that the reason was justifiable. And I remember her saying these words to me was, Dom, I have no problem that he's out of the game, because people thought we were showmans, and that's the last thing I need in this game. So I'm fine with it. And I remember being like relieved that she said that. But at the same time, I'm like, that was a pretty good answer for someone who is probably steaming right now, because there's no way I believe that she was happy that he was gone. I knew that she was really pissed that he was gone. There's no question about it.
I want to quickly go back to throwing the challenge and just the idea of that, because I was wondering where you thought that may evolve to, because it does seem like we're getting to the point where we hear from exit press and various other behind the scenes interviews and what have you, that throwing challenges is becoming far more common, even when it's not addressed on the show. But I, you know, for me, I would say throwing challenges in select spots, this goes all the way back to Richard Hatch in the final immunity challenge of season one, recognized how much smarter it was to lose the challenge than to win the challenge. And that won him the game, I would say, by a one vote margin. What do you think about where throwing challenges has gotten to and where it may be headed? Is this something that they may ever acknowledge, like explicitly on the show, being done and being smart and not trying to make the people doing it look bad?
Yeah. And I think that's what the issue, I think that's why it's not as popular as it would be right now, is because in past seasons, if you throw a challenge, It never looks good. It always looks like a bonehead thing because it ends up kicking you in the ass later on. So I think even me, a guy who's, I'll do anything, you know, a person who's, I'll take any risk, I'll do anything. I struggled with it for days. For days, I struggled with it. And I'm like, man, this is going to go bad and it's going to kick me in the ass later. But the reward of doing it outweighed the risk. And I said, I'm doing it. I have to do it. But like you said, it is such a strategic component of the game. Let's look at James, all right? When James took out Morgan, they should have kept it going. They should have thrown challenge after challenge and wiped me, Wendell out, Noble out. They could have wiped the three of us out after that. And instead, you know, like there's this sense of pride. You have to win and you got to do it for your team. And look, I mean, it's always better to not be vulnerable at tribal council, and winning is always the first option, so you don't have that vulnerability. But if you really have a handle on your group and you know that there's a common interest among the majority of you, and that common interest will allow throwing the challenge to, you know, get rid of somebody. I mean, I didn't even do it with the group. I did it myself with Chelsea. That was huge risk because the three people I was relying on were on the opposite tribe. You know, the three people I was relying on to do what I ask were Malolos. And that was a huge gamble in the game for me. And that's another thing that I wish, not even on television, but I wish it would have shown. I tried to explain it at Final Tribal. Nobody cared. But it's like, you have no idea how strategic that was. Can we all sit back and think about what would happen if Bradley was in the game right now? But no one wants to hear that because they've been voted out and they hate you. You know what I mean? So you can't really have that conversation.
Yeah, we were saying in week three when the Malolos pulled that fast one on you that it seemed like they had you guys dead to rights and they should just be throwing as many challenges as they could to wipe out the rest of you. But do you think that even if they considered that, the fact that they had lost three challenges by that point, and they were so used to this idea already that Malolo was cursed and that they were just destined to lose, it was like they were hungry for victory. They wanted to not give in to that and not accept defeat, even though that's the wrong way to think about
it. I don't think that they were tired of losing. I think that you didn't have the Malolos that were there, you didn't have enough risk takers in that group. I'm not saying they're bad players, but between Libby, who's really new to the game in general, right? Like, she's just fresh to Survivor in general, all right? And Laurel, I'd say if anyone would have been down with it, Laurel would have been, because she's a gamer and she's a diehard fan. I guess you could say the same thing about Donathan, but I just felt like their risk level is not where mine is, and I think even with my risk level as high as it was still difficult for me to do it. And I just think if you get people who are even more conservative than myself, then you're really not going to get the situation where they're going to do it. And I think all it would have taken on their team I think all it would have taken would have been one character to really like promote it and say, look, we have this opportunity. We can keep us together. And then when we get to the merge, we'll have the numbers again and Navidi, they can go home and blah, blah, blah. But I just don't think anyone really had the guts to pull the trigger on that. And I understand why, because it was even difficult for me to do.
Yeah, there was also James, who I guess temperament-wise seemed like the exact opposite of you. But I know he's come out and said he would have voted for you and game respects game there. Did he seem like the... the most prominent strategic threat at that point? Or what was your impression of just that entire group?
I tell you, it was hard because you didn't really know who was pulling the strings. Every one of them gave me a handshake and a smile and said, we're voting Angela out. And then when it was all said and done and Morgan ended up going home, they all spoke on a unified front. There was no one there that claimed credit for it. And again, Libby gave me the most comfortable feeling in the world. And to see that she didn't vote for Angela, I'm like, maybe she's the mastermind. You know, so like all those things I said about Libby being this cutthroat player, like I meant it in the moment because I didn't know who the hell was pulling the strings over there. But after having multiple conversations with James, I definitely knew he was definitely the most insightful, where he could play out all these scenarios in his head and go down Avenue A, B, and C and say, yeah, but this, then that. And I'm, you know, I know he does regret not having thrown those challenges. I've had those conversations with him. But yeah, I think sometimes you just need someone with kahunas to pull the trigger. But I got to tell you, though, I think it will now be more prominent in the game. Just because people are hearing about it after, even if they don't see it in the show, they're hearing that it happened afterwards. And Colin, like you just said, like Richard Hatch had the sense to know to get off that perch, right? Because he knew it was smart for him to not go in as the winner. This applies, and I know we're going to dig into the whole Final Four, but this is something that I could apply to the Final Four challenge. I should have stepped down and not won that challenge, because you need to look at throwing challenges in more than one way. You know what I mean? It doesn't, you don't have to throw a challenge just because it means you're going to get to do what you want at tribal. This is a new scenario. That's a new, you know, a new situation that has arrived at Survivor, where there's this Final Four fire making twist. And now it's really this whole diverse book of new rules and things you can do with it and things you can't do with it. And to me, there's no question I should have thrown that challenge, or at least, you know, just, yeah, whatever you want to call it, just not won.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to hear you and anyone who goes on the show acknowledge just how valid the idea of throwing challenges very often can be. I don't think we're going to frankly get there anytime soon, but I do think a future could exist where openly throwing challenges becomes acknowledged on the show and isn't necessarily like shamed. Because I do think generally when they show that on the show, it's because they want the person shown throwing the challenge to get their comeuppance and get voted out that night or whatever.
Yeah. And real quick, I always thought that the reason why they looked shamed is because like maybe production is mad that they didn't put their all into it. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's, Jeff Probst kind of does have that kind of spirit right. about him.
Right. Like, in other words, his team just spent a month building this, you know, construct
right.
of this huge challenge. And you shame these engineers by throwing the challenge and not even putting your heart into it. So that to me is the other component that I'm like, I don't want to shame the production team. I want to make sure that they know I'm very proud of the work they did, and I want to put my all into it.
Like but the Coach Wade factor of, like, honor.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. As crazy it is. But you know what? At the end of the day, you got to tell yourself one thing. Is Jeff Probst and John Kerhofer and the production team going to pay my mortgage? And the answer is no, they're not. So F those guys. If they don't like what I'm doing, screw it. And that's got to be the mentality going into it moving forward. Is well, that if you're on the fence about doing something, but you're afraid to do it because you think it's going to upset Jeff Probst, guess what? You're not playing the right game. You need to go out there and do what's best for you.
I completely agree with that. I love hearing you say it. One thing I wanted to ask about, going back to James kind of orchestrating that blindside early on, and Malolo just more generally orchestrating that blindside against Morgan. One thing you went back to many times in your discussion with Rob, and I loved it, was your constant just kind of some not even small necessarily, but a certain amount of fear at all times, and playing from a to at least certain degree kind of paranoid position, and always understanding things might not be exactly as they seem. Do you think, you know, obviously I'm sure in the moment it didn't feel great, but having that Morgan blindside go down early may have actually by the end of the season been helpful in keeping you on your toes at all times?
Absolutely. It was the best thing for my game that early on. It's an eye-opening experience. It's exactly what you need it's like I was a tribal council virgin, and you know, that was my moment to go through the ringer and by the skin of my teeth not be the victim of that vote. And I don't say it's the best thing that happened to me, because losing Morgan was not good for my game, because Morgan and I were really tight. So it didn't help me from that perspective, but it really opened my eyes to, wow, I got comfortable way too fast. And I realize now that I can never be comfortable again in this game. I need to always assume there's another plan in place, and it's up to me to decipher what that plan is and be sure I have a way to get myself out of it in the event they're coming back for me. So it was a blessing that it happened when it did. And as embarrassing as it was, because it looked like I was like completely out of the know, which I was, it was a great learning experience. And from that point on, it sharpened my game tremendously.
I think that makes a ton of sense. And I really did. As I said, I think that's something that we don't hear people talk about often enough, frankly, is that idea of fear really keeping you sharp out there on Survivor, and having, I think, that experience early on, that firsthand experience of seeing people confirming that a giant group of people has just successfully lied to your face. I would compare it almost to like a team, like a college basketball team going undefeated most of the regular season. And then it almost might be good to lose one before the March Madness tournament starts, so there's not that added pressure. And so, you know, more what to expect going forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Because there's always going to be somebody thinking something else, and you got to just be ready for it.
You're right. You don't need to go undefeated to win the championship. You just need to win the championship. Yeah.
Exactly.
I guess on the topic of just watching yourself on TV, was that a somewhat surreal experience as well? I don't know if you had any prior like TV experience or anything, but I imagine that if you're new to it, that's got to take some adjusting to as well.
It does take adjusting. And what's cool about it is I remember at the premiere, you know, we went to this local venue in my town, and I had like over 200 people there with us, and it was all friends and family, and my kids' school, you know, some of their friends from school and their parents and the teachers and the principal. It was crazy. We had a huge crowd, and I've never in my life been to an event. I've been to sporting events where the entire crowd cheers for the team, but it's the weirdest feeling having like 200 and something people cheering for you. And then it's like, that's just me. Like, I'm not any different. Like, it's weird because immediately, as soon as even your friends and family see you on television, they will start to view you a little bit differently. Not your real close friends. Your close friends and family know who you are. You know what I mean? But maybe like acquaintances, people you're not really that good of friends with, but you've seen and you've hung out with. Now, like, they're like, they just, again, it's not like I'm special, but it's like, it's just a different thing. And I kind of get it, because I had a friend from high school who was on a show once, and even as good of friends as him, I always looked at him differently than he did what he did on the show. And I was just like, that's just weird to me that people feel that way towards me now, because to me, I don't feel any differently. But then as you watch the season progress and you really start to see your own character develop, it was so weird, because I know it's me and I know the things I did when I was out there. But I'm not kidding. There's moments where you're actually like, I was actually like watching myself as a character and rooting for myself, if that makes any sense. It's like you're almost looking at yourself as a fictitious character on a show, and that you're hoping that person does well. And I actually found myself like, I know the result. I was there. But I found myself rooting for myself in the weirdest way possible.
It's an interesting like dissociation, I guess. I guess it would be even weirder if you found you weren't rooting for yourself, that you make the guy you were on TV. But luckily, I guess you stayed on course there.
No, but that falls into this. There was plenty of cringeworthy moments I had where I was like, ooh, did I say that? Or, I mean, obviously day one when I raised my hand, all these things, you know. How did I think my edit was pretty good. I really can't complain. They spent quite a bit of time. They spent a good amount of time on my story, I'd say. I always explain to people that this season could be perceived one of two ways. It could be perceived as, you know, there's many character developments in this, right? You got Kellen, all of them, even Stephanie Johnson, everybody on the show has their character development. I realize certain people like Chelsea didn't get any airtime. I really don't understand why she really did a lot more than they showed, especially with her and I. We did a lot of stuff on the side. Nothing that really may have had a direct impact, but definitely some indirect conversations. Anyway, but we all have these stories, and, you know, they always try to say, like, what does this winner's edit look like for Wendell? You know, and it's like, yes, he, you know, people do edgic and they try to determine.
No idea what you're talking about.
Right, right, right. So there's all these different things with the edit and how does it work, and who's getting this, and maybe Dom's the winner because look at Dom's edit and look at Wendell's edit, and they can't figure out who's going to win. And you guys, too. I heard your podcast where 1 week Dom was for me and then the next week Dom was for Wendell. I remember all that.
But, well, it was the same week that I was for you and then for Wendell and then for you again, just to clarify.
It's not like it doesn't hurt my feeling. I felt the same way. I'm like, they're editing this to completely confuse people to the very end. And it, I mean, well, job well done, because look how the ending ended up. But I think you could sit here and say that this season was a tale of two stories. I mean, more than that. I don't want to hog up and say it was just about me and Wendell. It wasn't. There was many stories, but For the finish game, for the end game, I think you can say that it was the story of how Wendell won, and it was also the story about how I lost, you know? So I had these really great moments of triumph and significance that made me proud and made my family proud. And I mean, I remember even like just winning my first individual immunity challenge. I think anyone that wins their individual immunity challenge will say the same thing. Like, but I remember just being with like my family for that and just seeing how proud you make your family and your friends. And again, it's like, it's just a stupid TV show. You're just doing a stupid challenge, but my whole community came together for this. And the one thing I constantly hear from people in my community, and I'm not even talking about people I've never met. I was getting yogurt last week frozen yogurt with my kids last week. And I went in there and it was these two families that came in and were like, oh my God, we loved you so much. And we don't know what to do with ourselves anymore. We had such a good time watching you. And just to hear like what it did to the neighborhood and friends and family, and to see that I was at least able to give them a good show, even if I didn't win it. I could sit there and say I held my head high, gave everyone a good show, and I think ultimately the edit for me was very positive overall.
That's what I was going to say, is I think I would describe it more as not the story of how Wendell won and how you lost. I would say it was the story of how Wendell won and how you almost won.
Yeah, because there are times when you have someone who wins and then someone who plays this very controlling game and loses. And often you see the signs from a few weeks out of how everyone is just talking shit about that person. And you can see why they're not going to end up with any jury votes. But with you guys, it's almost like a blessing for them, because you have two players who were very well-rounded, very well-balanced, and you have this very close vote at the end. So they can afford to boost both of you up rather than having right. to tear one of you down.
Right. And it sucked that some of those episodes towards the end were a little slow, you know. And I got that feedback from a lot of people. But at the end of it, we felt like we were able to at least deliver. Again, it's not like we're planning it when we're out there. We're doing what we're doing. You know what I mean? But I remember when the show ended, and I remember, you know, we were the final tribal just ended. And I remember Probe saying, you know, one thing. He said, guys, we have a great season here. You know, you may not see it, because you were involved in it. You may not think that there's magic in this season, but we just want you to know that this is a fantastic season. And I remember feeling like, is he just saying that to everybody every season? Like, or is this really a good season? And it's weird because like you see these dips and these peaks throughout the season where like the merge episode with Noble, and I'm not saying it because it's my season. It to me was one of the greatest episodes in the history of the game. And so at least we were able to deliver some of these real monumental moments. If the season as a whole doesn't, you know, meet top 10, that's fine by me. But at least like there were moments where we were able to keep the viewers on edge. And I think the finale kind of saved us a little bit in the fact that we did, you know, production had the entire viewing population guessing who's winning this thing on a week-to-week basis. And I love listening to it. Like I said, even listening to you guys, I like just hearing you guys like, you know, Colin, I changed my mind. I thought I knew. I thought it was Wendell, but now it's Dom. I don't know. And just like hearing that. And it's like, it's crazy because, you know, I know the result, you know, and it's like there's so many conversations and podcasts I've listened to from the whole time that I've been home all the way up to the finale where it's just like, you guys have no idea what's
coming.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for the heads up on the, yeah.
I know. So whenever Jeff says, I think the season is great, or maybe he gives a less enthusiastic prediction sometimes, there's always a lot of reading the tea leaves from the fans trying to work out, so what does this mean? Does this mean somebody can't win, somebody can win? And for you guys out there at the time, did you get the sense that they were happy with how the season was playing out? I guess by the end, Jeff said he was happy, but as you alluded to, you get the sense he's going to say that no matter what, right? Like, he's not going to tell you guys, your season was shit, we don't want any of you back, you know, you should have tried harder. So what were you thinking was their understanding of how well things were going?
Well, it's weird because, you know, I know I'm doing a lot of things on my end, right? You know, I know I'm making fake idols, showing Chris, and I know I have this fake one, and I know I'm going to pull this move, and I know in my confessionals I'm giving what I think is real good dialogue. And it's weird because you assume other people are doing the same thing. In other words, nobody knew some of the shenanigans I was doing, right? So I'm just under the assumption that we all are. And that when we see it all play out, it'll look like one big symphony of, you know, beauty as it plays out. And what ended up happening is some people may have made some moves. But, you know, it's weird because when you have people who are less strategic left towards the end game, it makes for a less explosive ending. You know what I'm saying? And that I'd say the ultimate reason why that happened is because all of the big names that left early in the game, you know, Stephanie and James and Bradley and even Brendan, I think, you know, I think he was really going to be a huge contender if he was later. You know what it is? Everyone is a certain way in the first 9 or 10 days of the game. But as you evolve in the game, you start to build confidence and you say, I'm going to take a swing at this and I'm going to take a swing at that. And these are all these players that went out pre-merge. These are all these players who 100% were going to develop into these players that are going to take those swings later, where you end up in the game with certain players who really were just there for vacation. And I'm not going to mention names. I don't think I need to. But they weren't really there to play the game. They were maybe just there for a personal journey, you know, and that's great, but we're here to play a game. And I think if some of those people that were there on a personal journey were maybe out of the game earlier, and some of the more life experienced players or, you know, whatever it may have been, were there later, I think obviously the game would have ended differently. But I think we would have had so many dips in those last few episodes. I think it would have been, in other words, I think it would have been more than just, is Laurel going to pull the trigger this week? You know what I mean? And I think it had more options out there.
In terms of that fan reaction, I think a lot of contestants take one of two approaches. So some of them disconnect entirely. They're not reading tweets, listening to podcasts. They're just kind of disconnecting from all of that. And in some ways, that might be the most healthy approach to take. And then on the other side of things, you've got you who's kind of engaging with people and consuming everything and following what people are saying about the show. So as you get through those first few weeks and you have some of these big episodes, you have that Morgan blindside, you see people saying, you know, this season's getting off to a great start. Maybe this is the best pre-merge cast of all time. And people seem to be pretty hyped up and excited. And then after that merge, when it does kind of settle into a rut, maybe, and every week it comes down to, will Laurel make a move? And then it's always just Naviti strong, Naviti strong. And you see people's frustration grow over time. Does part of you wish you could jump in and like defend the honor of your season almost? Or do you see where people are coming from there?
No, I do. And this is what I felt. I kind of felt that a little bit out there. And like I said, you know, Jeff said, you know, I remember the words were something along the lines of like, you know, I don't know if you think it went a certain way, don't worry about it. We have magic. We got good stuff here. But in my mind, I do recall feeling that there were like several days would go by where there was really no action. And I'm like, ugh, this is like, this is like a dud. You know, this doesn't feel like anything's going. Like, how are they going to make this good? I don't see how they're going to make this good. And I think that was the result. And again, it's not. I explain this that look, you're going to have dud episodes in a season, but the one thing you can take out of it is that it shows how genuine the show is. It shows that if the show wasn't real and it was scripted, every week would be explosive. And I think what you can get out of and can at least appreciate when you have seasons that have these drops in episodes where they're a little bit less exciting than other episodes is that at least you can appreciate the fact that, look, you got to take the bad with the good sometimes if you want it to be authentic. And because the show is authentic, you're not always going to have everybody running on all cylinders all the time. You're going to have these moments of rest and decompression where people are just like, you know what, can we just not play the game today? And if that's going to happen in human nature, it's going to show on the television screen. And I don't think there's an issue with that. I get it from a viewer's standpoint because it's a TV show, and at the end of the day, it needs to be entertaining and you need to keep your viewers. But in reality, it's authentic and it's not staged and it's not scripted and we're not fed food and we're not taking showers or dumps in a toilet bowl somewhere. We're out there fatigued and tired. So you're going to have these down spirals of energy levels, which in turn will prevent people from doing things because it's too exhausting to do it sometimes. And as much as it may be heartbreaking that it's my season and I wish every episode was a blockbuster, the one thing I can take out of it is that at least it's proof of how authentic it is, because in any situation that's real, you got to take the bad with the good. You know, some of these other shows you watch, every episode's a phenomenal. You know what I mean? But maybe those shows aren't as authentic as Survivor is. And this is, to me, what I really appreciate about it. And that's why I won't ever watch an episode ever again that may not be, you know, so explosive. I might say, look, man, that's the way it goes. You got to take the bad with the good with this show. But ultimately, we know the season itself will be entertaining. And that's what we're here for.
And for you, as the show is airing, you are now, I imagine, getting recognized. You're enjoying this minor celebrity, I guess is a way to put it. And so in one sense, it's a little bit up and down where you can go days without being recognized. And then you can have your watch party every week and hundreds of people are there just to see you and cheer you on. That experience in general of being a public figure, being recognized, some people respond well to that and some people really don't. And there are lots of contestants, not to name names, from seasons past who never really get used to that. And once their 15 minutes of fame are over and memories of their season start to fade, they're still trying to come to terms with how to make that a healthy part of their life. So what was that entire process like for you?
Well, the process is still going on as well, you know. And look, I look at it like if you're going to show me any appreciation at all, how dare I ever reject you in any way, right? I mean, so yeah, it's weird because you do one day you're nobody and then you do become recognized. And again, it's very spotty where you're recognized. I'm not Brad Pitt walking down Fifth Avenue. So I'll go 3 or 4 days and not one person will recognize me, but then I'll go 3 or 4 days in a row where I'll get recognized 3 times a day. You know, it just depends on where you are, the timing of it and all those things. And how I always I always have been super appreciative because I would never do anything shameful. Like I was given this opportunity, something that thousands or, you know, however many people would die to play this game. I was chosen, right? It's now my job to continue, even though the show's over. Again, I don't need to go out and promote the show. That's not my job. I have a family. I'm back with my family. I'm back to my life. I am on social media significantly less. I do check in. I mess around occasionally if I got time to kill. But I'm certainly not on it the way I used to be when the show was on. And now I still occasionally get recognized. I got recognized in the store today. And I'm grateful. And anytime somebody sees me and they say, oh, my God, my husband was your biggest fan. He'd never believe that I ran into you. And I'd say, come on, let's take a picture so you could show him. You know, so I'll always be open-armed about it and say I appreciate any love that anyone gives me. But it is a really weird thing because my whole life, I'm not anyone of any significance. I'm just a dad and a guy who goes to work and a husband, and then to have this little quasi, 15 minutes of fame, it's really weird. Even to this day, I can't get over it. It's very weird, but I'm super appreciative of it.
And I guess there are other people who they're at a point in their lives where they can get consumed by that. So sometimes you see cast members on season just meeting up in different parts of the country every single week, and you wonder how they can make that work. For you, for someone in your position, you couldn't do that even if you wanted to. You have so much else going on that this isn't going to like take over your life the way that it can do if you're not careful.
Yeah, and it's true because some of the younger players even that don't have the responsibilities that I have, not to say that they don't have responsibilities, but they're not locked into a family where they have to stay home. I mean, even a lot of the players I played on my season, like they're all traveling the world. James is on a Europe tour right now. Good for him. I love it. I'm living vicariously through him, through his pictures. but you're right. Some players, when it's over, it's the most heartbreaking thing that ever happened to them because this is the biggest thing in their life. And I get it. It's definitely life-changing no matter what you're – no matter where you are in life. You could even be, look, Jimmy Johnson, famous NFL guy. Don't say that Survivor, the experience of it didn't affect him in one way or another. So that's what I'm saying. It affects everybody in some way. But for some people, getting over it being over is harder to do than for others. For me, I felt I'm relieved. Not to say I wouldn't want to play again. I would definitely want to play again. But the break from it and the ability to breathe and take a step back is one of the most rewarding feelings I've felt in so long. And it's not like the feeling goes away if I'm at a party with friends of mine and they bring up the topic and we start to talk about it. I don't feel like, oh, I'm in the gutter again. I don't mind talking to friends and family. I don't even mind talking to fans that come up to me and approach me on the street. I'm fine with that. I still enjoy doing that. It's the fact that I'm not so engulfed in reading what people are saying about me or, just entrenched in the whole social media aspect. Just that was a very – as fun as it was, because most of the feedback I got was very positive. Don't get me wrong. I had my haters. Everybody has their haters. But for me, the majority of the commentary about me was very positive. So even if from a positive standpoint, the feedback being it was still an unhealthy lifestyle – to be on that thing all day checking it when, there's bigger things in your life you should be focusing on. But it's hard. It's like a vortex. You just get sucked into it and you can't escape because you're so involved in it. And especially for me who went the distance, I went from day one to day 39 and I was really curious how my story was being portrayed by the public. And I was curious if some of the things that were said to me by certain players in a negative way, some of the things, again, we're not going to get into that, but some of the negative feelings players had towards me, I want to see if it's being confirmed by the public or if it's being confirmed by production or in my edit. Is it coming off the way I was told I came off? So that was one of the most critical things for me because I knew I didn't win the game, but now it was important for me to find out I didn't win the game, but do I come out of this looking bad? Because at least I feel like I played a good game and I feel like I was a stand-up guy throughout the whole thing. But am I going to come out of this thing looking like a real shitbag? And that was really what was concerning me just based on the comments I heard from other players that I was not a nice person at certain times. So I think that was the biggest thing for me. I didn't care about the result. I knew the result. What I cared about was – in a way, it's not vanity. I guess there's a little bit of – you definitely have – there's an egotistical side to it as well that there's no question. Every one of us that are on Survivor, we have a level of ego that we want to see and we want it to be confirmed and we want to make sure people are loving us out there. We want to see if the social media world thinks we're as good as we think we are and all that nonsense. All that is out of our hands. It's because – we're in this vortex that we can't get out of, and it's just part of the entire experience where you just want to be reassured that the people are giving you love, because you want to make sure at the end of the day, you don't walk out of this thing looking like a real shitbag, like some past players have, you know what I mean? Like, Colton, you know, you want to make sure you're not walking out looking like someone like that. And that, to me, again, I didn't think I even came close to scratching the surface of a Colton. But again, I did get feedback from some players I played with who said I was not a great person.
And well, Colton even though put in a lot of work to get that shit back at it.
Right. So, but again, you're paranoid, you know, you're paranoid as it's airing. And
yeah.
You know, and seeing like the shenanigans, even in the premiere, and how visible I was in the premiere. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is going to be bad for me. I know it now. And so every week you're walking on eggshells, and you have a little level of paranoia where you think that maybe this thing's going to go bad at any minute. But I think it's, you know, I think I started to see that the positive edit I was getting throughout the early part of the season. I said, you know what, I think I'm going to be okay. But you're always on your toes, and you don't want to let your guard down, because that one moment where, you know, you look terrible out there, you know, that's the moment you're afraid of.
Yeah. We recently talked to your lovely wife, Kristen, about her perspective on how all of this went down and what it was like being home while you were gone and handling three little kids and everything else that goes along with that. But we would love to hear a little more just from your perspective about that. And if you think that impacted you more so than it would other people out on the island. Like, I know you talked about other people having a lot more at stake with just Survivor because this is the biggest thing they have going on. Whereas for you, you're always going to have bigger priorities. How tangible was that impact of having that family that you know is back at home and maybe something's going wrong out there with you at all times on the island versus the people who are young and don't have kids or anything they really even care that much about at home?
Yeah, and I don't want to discount anyone's situation. You know, my situation is my situation. Everyone's situation is theirs. And, you know, some people, right, have an easier time just saying, Mom, see you later. I'm going on Survivor, see you in 7 weeks, where some of us.
Yeah, I was saying to British Dom earlier today, if I were to go on and play Survivor, I don't think more than five people in my life would even notice that I was gone.
Yeah, well, no, I don't believe that's true. But yeah, so there is this thing. Now, here's what happened with Krista, and she was great, by the way. I couldn't believe she's a pistol. I knew she was going to bring it.
She was so good.
She's a natural. She's stealing some of your spotlight here.
First of all, Survivor wants her bad. Okay.
Oh, good. Survivor wants her bad. They got to get her on there, man.
She's not going anywhere. I'll say this, that. Now, you have to realize that I was in Survivor mode from the day I got called. And in my mind, I believed, even if it was a pipe dream, I believed in my mind I was going to be on the show one day, and I was going to be on the show one day soon. I got that call. I knew the wheels were in motion, and I was going to get on the show. What I started to do is start to really have concerns, or if I go, what about this? What about that? Taking off work, my paycheck, the kids, this and that. This whole time, Kristen's not thinking that. Kristen's going on with her life. She thinks there's no shot I'm getting on the show. And she's not mentally starting to prepare herself for anything. Okay. But I am. From October of 2016, when I first got my call, I'm starting to mentally prepare and starting to take necessary preparations in order to make this dream come true. And that means starting to feed the idea to my uncle, who's my employer, and start to feed it to my wife a little bit, who doesn't believe it's going to happen, but at least drop the seed to my kids, see what they say, what their initial reaction is. And what I'm now doing is I'm starting to like gather all this intel from the people around me on what the impact is going to be on my leaving. And now I could already feel the hurt in my heart of what it's like to leave my, you know, 3-year-old son at the time and my two daughters, 9 and 7, and my wife. And I'm not really concerned about missing work. I'm not going to miss that. But obviously people who are close to me and will my household function without me being there? Is it possible? I know we have a lot of friends and we have a lot of family for support, but Kristen's mother passed away back in 2004, and her mother, who would have been a huge component of taking care of this house in my absence, is not here. So, and my mother is really super busy because she still has a lot of kids living in her house. My youngest brother just turned 21. But there's a lot of kids, siblings of mine, who still live with them. So she doesn't really have the ability to pull out and spend 5 days at my house with my wife, or while my wife is away or anything like that. So what I'm trying to figure out is, how can I make this happen? I had so many hurdles to clear. I had to make sure my employer was going to approve it, my kids are going to approve it, my wife's going to approve of it. And not only are they going to approve of it, but will life function with me not being here in a manner that's still healthy enough for everybody? So, all right, we get the ball rolling. Now I get invited to go to casting in LA. Now she's like, all right, I come back from LA casting. She's like, how'd it go? I said, I think it went very well. But I still have another month and a half to wait before I get a call to find out I got the opportunity to play. So now it's like mid-April, and they call me to come. So April 16th or 17th of 2017. Got the call. Dom, you're going to play. I went crazy. I'm like, holy shit, I'm going. I can't believe it's official. All right, I hang up the phone. First calls to my wife. Chris, I'm going. They call me back. They want me. And this is – now, you got to remember, I had to already sell her a few weeks earlier that if I do make this, are you on board with it? And initially, she really was not.
Yeah,
and
I was going to say, I'll pay you $100 for the footage of that phone call of you telling her, I made it, I'm going.
Well, that phone call wasn't that expressive. But she was more like, yeah, okay. What you wanted to see on film was – me really trying to break it down to her as to why I have to go, and how there's this moment in our life where it's never going to be presented to us again if we turn it down. And I realize there's a million obstacles we need to get through, but if we can figure out a way to make this work, I am going to go out there. I'm going to make this happen, and I'm going to do it for us. And but again, she was never a fan of Survivor. So she doesn't care that I'm a fan of Survivor. She cares. She supports me and my interests and hobbies. But Survivor is not a hobby. You know, she knows I watch it on television. But she doesn't take it seriously. I mean, I don't even take it that seriously. But she doesn't. She especially doesn't take it that seriously. So for me to say how important it is, she's like, oh, all of a sudden Survivor is so important in your life. She's right. She has a point. Like, I only watched it on TV. It's not like I was listening to Dom and Colin podcast at this point. I wasn't listening to anything at this point. I wasn't doing social media, Survivor, anything. It wasn't until I really started to feel like I was going to make it onto the show where I started listening to the podcast and getting involved. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I just needed to make sure that she was comfortable with me leaving and that she had support from friends and family that are going to be with her in my absence. And also, in the event that she has to come for the loved ones visit, that she has additional support who are going to watch my kids. And the scariest part about it was that the loved one, well, we didn't know it at the time when the loved ones visit was going to be, but eventually what ended up happening was it was the week of 4th of July. And we were really concerned that whoever was watching her was going to take – was watching my kids. We're going to take my kids to some big firework party, and that nobody watches your kids better than yourself, and that one of my kids would either end up in a pool or getting their hand blown off by a firework. So these are all really serious concerns. But what the one thing that I think Kristen and I both didn't take into consideration, and it's something that I did – because like I said, I started mentally preparing for my departure in October of 2016. Kristen only started preparing for my departure in like April of 2017, a month before I left. And what happened in this process is that she really didn't recognize the significance of my absence. And I don't think I did either. But we both kind of went into it nonchalantly, like, all right, I'll see you in 7 weeks. No big deal. And now she's not missing the kids. She's just missing my presence. She's missing me. Now I'm occupied in the game. And what I've learned to do at this point, since October of 2016, I've been mentally preparing myself, telling myself that I am going to learn how to compartmentalize – these feelings that I'm going to have occasionally while I'm out there, where I'm really missing my wife and kids, where I'm really missing home, and I'm going to have these homesick moments, and I know I'm going to, but I need to train my brain to do it, where I'm not going to let it involve, get, you know, break down my game or have any impact on my decision making in the game. And for some reason, I was able to do that. I told myself months going into the game before the game started, you have to just put that in the shelf. Put that on the shelf when it happens. Put that on the shelf. And I constantly ran it through my brain. But Kristen wasn't doing these mental exercises the same way I was. She wasn't able to, you know, shelf this absence of me being there. And again, it's not that I'm so great. But when you're with someone for 20 years, we've been dating since 1996, so 22 years we've been together. When you're with someone every day for 22 years, and then they just disappear from your life with absolutely no communication, you don't realize the toll that it could take on you mentally. And again, the reason why this is a thing for me, because I think Kristen got a lot of negative feedback from military wives or military spouses in general, saying how dare she complain about her husband being on a game show, and nobody is comparing going on Survivor to someone who's in the military. What they do is real. What we're doing is a joke. But that being said, what we want to recognize is there's still this emptiness. There's this void that a significant couple who spent every day together for 22 years, there's this immediate void that just slaps you right in the face that you didn't realize would have such a mental impact on you. And for her, she didn't see it coming. She didn't see it coming at all. And one day it hit her like a ton of bricks. And she went through this process as she describes it to me. I wasn't here, so I couldn't really speak to her for her, but I'm pretty sure she gave you the rundown. But how she described it to me was that she actually felt that she would wake up in the middle of her sleep having nightmares that I was dead. And again, it's not to compare it to anyone in a real situation who does have their spouse or their loved one in a situation that's truly life-threatening. We're not saying that. But we're allowed to say that when two people love each other and they spend every day with each other for 22 years and now there's this void, it's going to hurt. I don't care what the situation is. It's going to hurt. And I, when she came out to loved ones, I was expecting her to come out with a big smile on her face. I expected tears, but I expected a laugh. The same way you see everyone else come out where they're crying, but they're laughing and they're happy to see you. And when I saw the look on Kristen's face, I knew. I mean, it's funny, but I knew immediately. In other words, I wanted this to be my moment to break down. You know what I mean? Like, I needed a moment to break down. And I started to, as she was walking out of the bushes, this was going to be me just letting it all loose. This is what I've held in for 33 days or whatever day it was. This is what I've been shelving and compartmentalizing for this long period of time. And this was my opportunity to spill my guts all over the place. And instead, when I saw her condition, I say her condition because she really did not look well to me, I realized that I could not have this moment where I get to just be completely vulnerable, and I now need to be strong for her because she needs my support. So it was like an immediate instinct that just kicked in where I had to take care of her. And it sucked because we still were filming a show, and I really couldn't just take her aside and say, babe, talk to me. Tell me what's going on, because the whole time we're being filmed and I'm trying to like not let our too much of a personal life be aired. So I was kind of like pulling back on some of the things she was starting to say. And I was trying to like shut her down a little bit because she doesn't realize that she could say some really deep stuff and that could end up on national television. And I was concerned that that might be the case. So I was hoping that there would be a moment where I could just at least say something to her. But I realized that the risk of family loved ones, you may not end up spending that time with them. So long story short, the whole thing with her is that she just really had this really traumatic experience that I think took us both by surprise, but it really kicked her in the ass a lot harder than it did me because I had the ability to, like I said, shelf and compartmentalize those feelings because I was involved in a game and I had to stay sharp in my game. And for her, she didn't have anything like that to occupy her. All she had was the kids at home who were just constant reminders of why she misses me. And it wasn't a really great situation for her to be in. And I think, you know, I think we learned a lot about each other. I think we definitely came out really strong from it. And I think we have a real deep appreciation for each other. We always did, but it's just something different. The experience of not being with each other for 7 weeks without communication at all, I think it's a real it's a rejuvenation to the relationship for sure. And I think we've never been better at this point.
So for you, it sounds like overall Survivor was this success story. And I know you said that when you were going through the casting process, you had this confidence that if you did go out there, you could do well. And I guess everybody thinks they're going to win. And it's always a shock to like 18 out of the 20 people when they don't. But in your case, that confidence at least seems to be well-founded. But you know how these things work. You've played poker before. You understand anything like this has a level of variance in it. And whether it's your mistakes or a twist or something else, you might have an outcome in this game that is disappointing. Maybe you go out pre-merge. Maybe you throw it all away somehow. If this had ended not necessarily in failure, but in a way that was disappointing, where you're not bringing home the second place prize money, you're not being regarded as one of the best players to never win, one of the icons of the season, how do you think that would change your reflections on the experience and also how your family would have come to terms with it, whether it would have been worth it in retrospect?
Yeah, for me, it would have, you know, it's weird because I would have looked at it two ways. Like if I went out really early, like Jacob Derwin's second spot, which I know he's devastated, and I get it. I would feel very similar. And again, I haven't really spoken in depth with him about his feelings about it, but I just know how devastatingly disappointed he is in his outcome. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, we're fans of the game. And again, I'm not a super fan, but in any means, I can't recite the winner of season, whatever, but I have organically watched the show for 20 years. Okay. So to me, I have the show in my blood and now I have the opportunity to play it. And if I was to go out early in the game, I would be completely heartbroken. And the reason is that I would have felt that they didn't give me a chance. They didn't give me an opportunity to get to know me. If they would have just gotten to know me, they'd see who I am and I could have been helpful to them and this and that. So I think the same thing applies to anyone that goes out early. It's that it sucks. It's a situation that you can't avoid because that's the nature of the game. But I think I could relate to the idea that if they would have just gotten to know me, I know I might have came out of the gate the wrong way or I came out of it hot. But if they would have just gotten to know me, I think they would have loved me. And I think I could have played a much better game. And I think if the circumstances were different for me, I think it would have more of an impact on me going out early than the way the game ended for me coming in second in a tie. And don't get me wrong, I have these moments with the tie, and it's not even about the tie so much as losing the game by one vote, or in the gambling world, you can call it a half a vote.
Yeah.
If you're in the, right.
I lost, you still covered. I had you getting right. +1.
Exactly. Yeah. So to have lost by a vote, it's sometimes I'll go through my day perfectly normal. And then it's weird. I'll have this moment of, oh, and there's multiple reasons why it'll just kick me in the ass at some random point during the week. Again, 3 or 4 days go by, I will think about it. And then one day I'll just be like, oh, yeah. Because, and there's a lot of reasons why. Obviously, you know, it's a more comfortable life to have an extra $900K in your pocket. And that's the way it goes. But also, it would have been nice you know, I could say that I played a good game, and I can hold my head up high, and I think a lot of people will say I played a great game, and that's fine, and that's what I ultimately wanted as well. I wanted the money, but I also wanted to go down as one of the winners who played a really good game. So yeah. You know, I'll take it for what it was. Let me just mention though how it would have went for Kristen if I would have went out early. My family, I'd say my kids wouldn't have noticed a difference if I my impact on the game. I think for my kids' perspective, for me to get voted out early from a television standpoint, it was way cooler that dad was on TV for 13 weeks in a row, and literally her school just became engulfed in the whole experience with us. So from their standpoint, if I would have went out in the first episode, it would have been a huge letdown to the community and to my kids, I'm sure. For Kristen, it would have been a totally different experience because she knows what happens if you go out, or even if you're out of the game, there's the pre-merge trip or there's the Ponderosa lifestyle, right? Two situations that are probably not ideal for a married man. There's a lot of partying.
She mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's a lot of partying that goes on. There's a lot of situations that are probably not ideal. And I get it. I'm not going to sit here and say she's crazy. You know, that's the way it goes. But, you know, our relationship is so strong. It's not something I would ever be concerned with. And I think ultimately she knows that to be true as well. But I think still just the idea, it's not necessarily that she, it's not a trust issue. It's more the idea that, like, great, I'm home running this house while you're out partying. I think is more the gist of what the gripe would be about. Not that there's a concern of trust, but that the fact that she's manning the house while I'm in Australia swimming in the Great Barrier Reef and drinking tequila out of, you know, a bamboo shoot or something crazy. Like, even that's not fair, right? Like, if I was to do that, I mean, sure, it's great for me and my life experience resume. And I could say I went here or I went there on the pre-merge trip and I got to do this and I got to do that. But it's kind of like, and even with the situation in the game where I did play for 39 days, I come home and say I was given this opportunity to fulfill a dream of mine. I feel like she got the short end of the straw because she made the sacrifice so I can do it. So now the question is, what dream of hers do I get her to live? You know what I mean? And it's
the tough. Answer is a swimming pool, it seems like.
Well, for now, that's what it is. But I mean, I think she would love to play one of the games, you know, but she knows in her heart she can't leave her kids the way I had the ability to do it. And again, it was through serious mental training that I did it. And I just think it's different for her. I think if my kids were a little older, she could pull it off. But right now, my kids are too young and she wouldn't. But somewhere down the road, I think she's going to be presented with an opportunity. I'm not talking about TV, but I'm going to figure out a way to repay her for giving me this experience. Because, I mean, the sacrifice that she made is beyond anything I could ever do for her. And I hope she knows how much I appreciate that she let me do it because – you know, it was a huge sacrifice to everyone who was a part of it. And,
yeah,
you know, and for her to have made it, you know, I owe her one. Let's just say that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, we had such a great time talking to her. And truly, I think one of, like, you know, we're not really known for our touching moments on the podcast. But for me, I would say one of, like, the most touching moments that we've ever had in Dom and Colin history was her talking about how just truly proud she was of what a good job you did, even though it didn't end up going your way. I really loved hearing her whole perspective on that. And I would definitely recommend for anyone who hasn't heard that interview to check it out. But speaking of Kristen and the kids, one thing she mentioned was the kids in particular not necessarily being so on board with the idea of you going back and doing this again, which seems like a very realistic possibility. Where is that right now? And what do you think? Do you think that's something that could change? Like, you could change their mind if it came down to it?
I think my kids are actually on board.
Oh, okay, like, good.
Yeah, my kids are not the issue. I think because now that it's over, I think my kids miss it. You know, and both of my son is 4, so he still doesn't have any concept of it. But both of my daughters told me, "Dad, we want you to go back." And I was like, "Oh, all right, it's good to hear that you guys are cool with that." Kristen is obviously reluctant, but I believe that she would have my back if the opportunity presented itself. It is weird though because, first of all, I want to make sure that I would have to make sure that she doesn't, or we don't, you know, get ourselves in the mental state again that, she was to the point where she was like actually sick, you know, and I don't want her to get to that point again. So I don't know if I did go out and play a second time, would she be more mentally prepared? Or is the question is she going to make herself sick knowing how sick she got the first time of me being gone? So I don't really know. And I'm going to leave it up to her. First of all, I've not gotten any opportunity to go back and play. But in a hypothetical situation where I was given the opportunity, I definitely would like to play again. But again, it has to, the stars need to be aligned. My employer, it needs to work for the same way it worked the first time. It needs to work the second time. But also, I need to make sure that mentally Kristen is good for it, and that I'm not, you know, leaving any casualties behind.
Dom, now seems like as good a time as any. This is something we've been really dying to talk to you about for a long time, just hear kind of your extended thoughts on. It played obviously a very critical role in how this season ended up playing out. The Final Four Fire Challenge. You referenced earlier, back when we were talking about throwing challenges, that would be something that may come up again when we get to this part of the conversation. Where would you want to dive in on a kind of a deeper discussion about the theory behind this new twist that, at least at the time of this recording, seems to be a staple going forward in the game Survivor?
And quickly, I know on with Rob, you said that you could do a 3-hour podcast about this. Let's keep it to a little more brief than that. Yeah. But the floor is yours. In as much detail as you feel like is appropriate.
Yeah. All right. Well, how I'm seeing the Final Four and how I believe it will evolve is that, you know, let's look at season 35 briefly, where you see Chrissy wins and she's taken Ryan no matter what. And she's put in a situation where she wants the greatest opportunity to take out her biggest threat, who is Ben, right? The same situation applies to me, where I know I'm bringing Laurel. And I guess Angela was my greatest opportunity to take Wendell out and fire him. Wendell's my biggest threat, right? So it's almost almost an identical scenario where you see that it was played very vanilla, in other words, where it's the obvious thing to do, right? You're gonna guarantee yourself in the final three. You're gonna take the next person, I guess. Actually, not necessarily you're going to take the next person who you know you can beat in the final three, but you'll take the lesser of the more likely to beat your biggest threat in fire. Okay, in that situation, Ryan for Chrissy, and for me, it was taking Laurel, taking Laurel, because Laurel didn't show any enthusiasm whatsoever in even making fire up against Wendell. Angela showed me a little bit of it. So now what we're looking at now is two situations that are almost identical, where the player is going to do this thing that's safe, right? They're taking the safe route. They're guaranteeing themselves. And then they're going to do the best they can to take their biggest threat out of the game. And what's happening so far, 2 out of 2 times, is the biggest threat is winning the fire challenge. And that biggest threat is going on to win the game. And I think what people are going to start to see, and new players who play the game are going to start to see, is that there's more opportunities and moments here. And it starts back at the Final Four Challenge. Okay, so now you can look at it and say many, many things. Okay, if I win this challenge, it's now up to me to go in front of a jury and decide which two people are going to go up in fire-making challenge. And now, as intelligent as I like to think I am in the game, I wasn't able to see the repercussions of me putting Wendell up against Angela and seeing that it almost looked distasteful as my final six moment that I had, that everyone says I had. It's as if I put Angela out for the next slaughter. Like, we just did it with Sebastian. We just did it with Donathan. And now we're going to do it with Angela. Like, I'm sending these people to their death one by one. And what I really should have taken into consideration is that this might be a good opportunity to let Wendell look like the guy who's, you know, turning people into victims. Because if he would have won, he would have done the same thing I did. He would have put Angela up against fire against me. And it might have made me look a little more, or not, I don't want to say heroic, because at that point, I don't think I'm looking like a hero, but I'm looking less aggressive because it's not my fault. I have to do the fire. I have to fight for my life. But Wendell would have been the one who decided to put me there. So you can blame him for Angela's slaughter. So the same thing is, like you said, with Hatch letting go of the perch, right? Like, he recognized that there's a scenario here where he's not going to look great. So he backed off and he figured out a way he's going to win this thing by stepping down. And that's something, this is the first piece of the challenge, the first piece of the puzzle, where I think you're going to start to see people really see that there's an opportunity here that, do I actually want to win this challenge? And if I do win the challenge, what are the repercussions of me winning it? Yes, I'll have control, but is having control necessarily the best thing to have in this scenario? Especially if you think you can make fire. Like, for me, like, if Wendell would have won that challenge, I would have beaten Angela or Laurel in fire. It just would have happened, right? So what was I risking? Like, why was I so adamant about winning this Final Four challenge? I don't understand. It made no sense to me. At the time, it's like, that's what you do on Survivor at Final Four. You win it because you want to have control. You want to decide who's going to Final Three. But there's this whole new element called the fire-making twist, which we know has played out on season 35, but we have not yet witnessed how it works and what are the repercussions on what happens when you take people. And our minds just weren't that good enough to really develop the scenario in our head. So for me, it was do the safe thing and send, I win the challenge. I'm going to fight my heart out to win the challenge. I did win the challenge. And now I take the safe route and I send Angela up against Wendell. Hopefully she takes Wendell out. She doesn't. He wins. And then I immediately regret this decision that I started to play around with, that if I don't think Angela or Laurel can take Wendell out, why don't I attempt taking him out? And again, we're not going to talk about why I did or didn't, because we know I could briefly say I didn't because I believed I had a leg up on him in the game. I thought I played a better game. I thought I spoke better than him. All these things I kind of spoke about on the podcast with Rob, but that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is what is my view on it now? My view on it now is that you don't necessarily have to throw yourself into the ring, but you do have these opportunities now where it doesn't necessarily have to go a specific way. You don't necessarily have to say, I'm going to play it safe and I'm going to have this one take that one on because that one's my biggest threat. And if that one's my biggest threat, this one's most likely to beat that person and that person will go home and blah, blah, blah. All I'm saying is that this is now a huge moment in the game where you can now go from somebody who hasn't done much in the game to maybe looking like a hero. And let's say you didn't take risk in the game at all, right? Let's say you played a real low-key game the whole time, but you're physically very good in challenges, and you're very good with making fire, all right? Let's just call this person Joe Schmo, I don't know. So Joe played a great game. He didn't do anything strategically, really. He didn't do anything. He might have won a few challenges, but now he goes to Final Four. He wins the Final Four Immunity Challenge. He comes to the Tribal Council with the necklace on, and he knows the three people sitting there, he can kick their ass in fire making. So now Joe, who hasn't done anything the whole game, who's now wearing the immunity idol, takes the idol off his neck, puts it on someone else's neck, and sits at the fire making station and says, I'm ready to show the jury this is why I'm going to win this game, because I'm willing to risk my life in this game to make sure that the final three people in this game are the final three people that I want there. And those two are the people I want, and I'm ready to risk right now my own life in this game by taking on this other person on this game in fire making. And that, I don't care what you say. If I'm on the jury and someone comes out and gives that speech and they put their own ass on the line in the game when they already had a guaranteed spot in the final three, guess what? You may have just changed my mind when it comes to voting for the million. And this is what I'm trying to say, is that there are these huge opportunities in Final Four now, and it starts with the Final Four challenge, and it works its way all the way into the fire making challenge, where there's these multiple little scenarios where you can play and really think about and get creative with what you can do with this opportunity. And like I said, for a player who may not have done much, this may be an opportunity for them to shine, and shine at the right moment, right before people are ready to vote for who gets the million. It's also a situation for like what would have been for me, an opportunity for two strong players who go to the end. I may or may not think I could beat Wendell at the end, and this is an opportunity for me to step up to the plate. And if I would have, you know, followed through and went through with the plan to take Wendell on and fire and have beaten him, I'm fairly certain in my mind I would have won the game 10-0. So there's this other thing you weigh out. Do I want to battle somebody in the final three where the votes will be close, or do I want to put it all on the line and either go broke or, you know, go big or go home? And these are the moments people need to grasp now, because this is what's going to really carve the game at the end. I mean, it's going to always lead to a huge explosive finale now. And no matter what the outcome is, it should be a very explosive outcome. But again, you need to see the evolution from the way Chrissy and I did it to when people start looking at the Final Four as this ultimate opportunity to make something big happen.
So tell me if you agree with this, because I would say the way to view your situation is both you and Wendell are essentially 100% to win fire against either of Angela or Laurel, and being the person to win fire is probably going to be a pretty good thing in your situation. So when you have the necklace there, between you and Wendell, it's going to be very helpful for whichever one of you is the one to win the fire challenge. So when you have the necklace and you can essentially decide who's going to be competing in fire, including yourself, I would say the way to view this decision is when I know that between me and Wendell, it's a toss-up both in a jury vote and in fire, I think it has to just come down to whichever one you feel better about. And if you feel like fire is basically 50-50 with Wendell and you think you have the edge on him with the jury, you have to go that route. But if you thought you'd be like a slight underdog in the jury and a slight favorite in fire, you have to go and take him on at fire. It seems like it just comes down purely to those two numbers, unless I'm missing something. Do you think that makes sense as far as you're concerned?
I couldn't agree more. And the one thing I'll say is that I never got an opportunity to see Wendell make fire, right? I practiced fire. I was okay at it. You know, I work with my hands. But yeah. Wendell creates furniture and he was tying knots and he was doing a rope and he was constantly making crafts with his hands out there. So something about it was telling me that this guy has the ability to make fire and make it fast because he's just good at everything else he does. You know,
he had like a fire making gazebo out there in the woods for him. Yeah, and Laurel.
I didn't even know that. You know, he didn't tell me that until after the game. But I went to many tribals with Wendell, and again, he sat back a lot. And then when he did speak, he kind of spoke softly, and he didn't elaborate or articulate a point as much as I would. And I always thought that that was kind of my ability. I thought I was better at that than him. And I thought that that would give me an edge going into final. I also believed, look, I won more individual immunities than him or anybody else, right? That's another thing for my resume. I also believed I found the most stuff out there, whether it was a fake idol or a real idol. I felt like I'm trying to describe myself as that complete player, right? I won most individual immunity challenges. I found idols. I found fake idols. I made fake idols. I pulled off this bluff. I realized it was distasteful. I understand you guys are hurt by it, but please understand what I was trying to do. I'm here for my family. I'm trying to win this. I'm like, you got to see what I'm saying. So in my mind, this conversation I'm about to have at Final Tribal sounds to me like a better resume than Wendell's. I also feel like I have the ability to speak better than Wendell. And something gave me a vibe. I don't know why. I just felt like even though shit went bad with Noble, I felt that he respected game. And I thought in my mind that he had a big voice and that he actually may come around for me. And he ended up doing that. Him and Jurger were my spokesperson people out there. I'm telling you, these two guys fought to the death for me. And I'm eternally grateful to both of them for that. But what I'm trying to do is show you how I outweighed the reasons why I didn't go to fire making with Wendell. You know, and like you said, it's if you think you have an edge in the game and you're not sure about beating him in fire, you take that route. But if you think you're sick at fire making and you're not really sure about the outcome in the votes in a final three, then you got to throw your ass on the line in fire making. And that's what's going to be the formula for any player playing the game moving forward. They really need to put themselves in that situation. Or like I said, get creative. There's more, even those few situations and scenarios I just gave you, there's more possibilities out there that exist. You just have to get creative and figure them out.
Are you still the number one advocate for this being a good twist that should stick around for a while?
I do, because I'm not going to say I'm the number one advocate. Did I say number one?
All you right. said I'm number a, one. All right, JP. I heard it this very afternoon. So all right. Fake news coming over from your side of the conversation.
You may be one of the only advocates, so that would make you number one by default.
Well, and I think the reason why I am a supporter of it is that because of all these scenarios I think that you can create. And I think it's going to be good for the game, and I think it's going to bring the game to the next level. I am a supporter of it. I am, even though
top 10 supporter of it, at the very least.
Minimum top five supporter. Listen, this challenge, this twist burnt me. Oh, I think I read somewhere that people are like, oh, Dom's just saying that because he's kissing ass on, kissing CBS's ass. It's not true. I truly, genuinely support it. And I support it because of what the scenarios I just told you. I believe it's going to create better players. I believe it's going to create a better show for viewers. If we just need people to figure out and realize and recognize its potential. There's something there. But you got to remember, even season 37 players who filmed already got to see it in 35, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
obviously, yes. All right, so season 37 players who are done filming and are home now, they got to see it play out on 35. So will that group of players see the potential in it and make something crafty come out of it? For me, I like to say it's as new to me as it was to season 35 because I didn't see it play out. So don't blame me for not getting crafty. You know what I mean? But I do blame me for not getting crafty because that's what I should have done in that moment.
What do you think about Jeff Probst in general and just the role that he plays within the show and the job that he does?
I have a lot of respect for, again, I'm not sucking his kneecaps here. Not just Probst, but the whole operation is a well-oiled machine. And there's times when you're out there and you're in waiting, like you're in a holding facility or tent or something, and I'm not going to get into that too much, but you're in waiting and you're questioning, why are we waiting? Why are we doing this? I don't understand. Why do we have to wait? Why can't we just do this? And it's not till like later in this, experience of being out there that you realize there's a reason for every single thing that happens in production. And let me tell you something, after 36 seasons, these people have it down to a science, and every second is spared accordingly. So when you think that you're just sitting there waiting to go into a challenge because someone forgot to tie a rope up somewhere and you have to wait for that to happen, that's not what's happening. They make sure that everything is strategically timed out in a way that allows the show to run itself, so that there's the minimal amount of missteps to take place during the production, because the second there's a misstep, that hurts the authenticity of the actual actions of the show. So everything they do, and I'm telling you, what Probst does, you will never find anybody have the, it's his specialty. So I'm sure people are as good at their craft as he is in their specialty. But I can't imagine anybody else doing it as well as him. I can't. I genuinely don't know who that person would be. He's not just a guy sitting there talking to you at Final Tribal Council and yelling at you when you're doing challenges. He is legitimately running the show there. And he's making decisions on the fly that you need to have the ability to do that. When someone surprises you at Tribal Council and does something that you may not have anticipated, the way he can react to it baffles me. And not only in Tribal, but at a challenge, he may decide, you know what, we weren't going to send someone to Ghost Island, but now we are, because I think it would make sense to do this. And I'm not saying he did or didn't do that, but that's an example of something he may have done, where he'll just decide that, Ghost Island was out, but now it's in, because I just realized that this is – this is going to be better if we do it this way. So he sees 30 steps ahead. We're playing in the moment. We only know what's the now. We could try to strategize for the later, but Probst can see this game, the big picture version of it, and he knows how to put the right tools in the right places so that the game runs flawlessly. And I'm telling you right now, there's nobody who does it better than him. And anyone that says they can are out of their effing mind. There's nobody.
Yeah. Along similar lines, I'd love to hear your take on the new Final Tribal Council format and Jeff's kind of expanded role there and the new emphasis on the three different parts of the game. What do you think about that? You know, and of course, the jurors no longer going up one at a time, but having much more of a back and forth. What do you think about that being another new staple to the show? And do you think that impacted your Final Tribal Council at all, either positively or negatively?
I think it's positive. Look, it's the same. It relates to the same question you asked about the abundance of idols and advantages in the game, right? I told you I'm a fan of that as well. I'm a fan of idols and advantages. I'm a fan of the final fire making twist and the new format with that. And I'm also a fan of the new final three format where it's you're bouncing things off each other. And the reason why I say I'm a fan of all those things, because for me as a player and a person who can see a situation and get creative with it, look, in the final four, I just told you all the ways that I could have utilized that situation. So to me, if I ever do play again, I want to have the ability to utilize a situation like that again. And the same thing applies to idols and advantages. I want to have the ability to get creative with an idol where I may be able to bluff somebody and salvage my real idol or whatever it may be. And there's an opportunity in final three now where there's this open forum discussion where there's this back and forth where people get to jump in on the conversation. The one thing I'll say, though, Probst may sound like he's more involved now than he used to be, but he's really not. He just delivers that first line about tell me why you were outlasting the other guy. It's really just his way to get the ball rolling. But he doesn't say anything once the ball is rolling. His dream is to not have to speak at these things. He wants to be able to sit back and let us kill each other. And we did the job for him. If he has to speak, that I would imagine that's a burden to him. Whereas if he could just plant the seed and let the fireworks go off, that to me is his ideal situation. So now you have this open forum. And instead of just having one person come up to you and just completely destroy you, and then if you try to reciprocate or say, look, can I respond to that? And that person says no and goes back to their seat. Well, you just lost an opportunity to address that person. For me, I want as many opportunities as possible to use my creative abilities to fix or create a situation that's more ideal for me. So this open forum allows that to happen. This allows me the opportunity to say, look, I realize that I left a sour taste in your mouth at final six with this bluff with Donathan and with Sebastian. But this is an opportunity. I get to explain to you why I did it. And why it happened. And like I said, at the end of the day, it didn't change their minds, but at least it gave me the opportunity to really explain myself, and it allowed other people to jump in. And when the conversation starts getting going and you have this back and forth, that to me is where I'm in my element. So for me, I support it. I support these things that are very controversial. I know that a lot of original Survivor OG fans say it's nonsense because it's taken away from what the show used to be. But what we really want to do is create scenarios where people can get more creative than just a real bland like scenario where it can only go one way and not the other. You want more than anything multiple possibilities for multiple scenarios because that makes the best show. And again, take away the television component of it. Let's say I'm playing the show for $1 million and it's not televised. I still want this opportunity to plead my case in an open forum because I think it's better for my game. And anyone that really is in, I don't know. I would imagine, I can't imagine many people not thinking the new format is the better way to go.
Yeah, it feels like if you are a jury member, then maybe you want that chance to get up and say your piece and not have to be involved in anything larger than that. But as someone who is facing the jury, even if you think someone next to you can out-talk you and maybe operates better in this new format, it's got to be refreshing to have a chance to be in that conversation. You're not going to be sitting there helpless as someone just gets up and goes on some diatribe against you and sits down and you don't have the right of reply. So I think regardless of who you are, as a finalist, it's a good place to be. To close on Survivor as an experience for you, so I know you mentioned in your interview with Rob that you can imagine this being a learning experience, that you will take away things from this that will be a big deal in your life. And going back to the start of this interview, you mentioned that your child being born was a big push for you towards getting in shape and changing these areas of your life. What do you think this will lead to in terms of a personal transformation or maybe something less grand than that?
Well, no, it is. It's just another chapter of my journey, you know, and I took away things from this, like I had mentioned earlier. Like, so my children being born taught me to appreciate, you know, the fact that I want to be there for my kids when they get married and have kids. I want that in my life. That's important to me. I want to be a part of their lives. I don't want to be some deadbeat dad. So that got me to turn that light on and say, I'm going to turn my life around and do that. Now I've really well conditioned myself to being a dad and a husband, and I'm a complete 180 from myself 10 years ago, and things are very good. But it doesn't mean it's not ever room for improvement, right? Every one of us could be a little better, right? So this opportunity here, you stuck me in a situation with 20 strangers, and this is the greatest opportunity to really self-experiment with yourself and see – you know, yeah, you're playing for $1 million, but it also gives you an opportunity to really see many things, how patient you can be with people, how open-minded you can be with people. And even the things that I said where people said negative things about me, it has me constantly trying to be more aware of how I talk to people in my real life every day now. So it's just another thing that I can say, you know, brought me to the next level, whatever you want to call it, you know, a little bit of improvement, even if it's not that significant of an improvement, at least is awareness. And I'm never going to stop trying to improve, you know, whatever it may be, fitness, everything in my, every aspect of my life, I'll always be trying to do better. I think that's human nature in general, right? So yeah. If I can say that Survivor gave me this little thing that just added to the many lessons in life that I have, you know, sure. I mean, it's amazing. It's great. It's the greatest thing ever that I can take that away from it and I could, you know, utilize it in my real life. So no question about it. It's been great.
I know you will have a lot of fun times ahead of you and a lot of stuff that you'll continue to work towards. But in terms of these big adventures, these big life moments, does this feel like a last hurrah of sorts? Because you're a family man now. You're not in your 20s. You can't just go on some like impromptu road trip and have a bunch of great memories from that. If you want to do anything on this scale, it's a big commitment, not just for you, but for other people in your life. And whether or not you go back to play Survivor again, is the Survivor experience the kind of capstone to all of that, for lack of a better word?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, is this like that... yeah, climactic moment of life experience of doing that. But I don't, you know what it is? I find more fulfillment in my real life than I do on Survivor. I mean, sure, Survivor, it gave me the opportunity to really throw my balls back in the ring, if I call it. You know what I mean? Like, it allowed me to do those dangerous things I did in my 20s without really risking anything that's going to be detrimental to my health, my finances, my relationship with my family. But it still gave me the opportunity to have that adrenaline rush again that I used to have in my 20s, where I would really take these chances and take these risks and, you know, find that blood driving feeling. So I will admit, that is not existent anymore because I'm out of the game. But I mean, what I do in my real life with my family, it's like, it's not as energy driven, but it's more fulfilling. You know what I'm saying? And for me, I don't see this as like, you know, that's it. It's a wrap for me. It's just opened my eyes to how many more things I'm capable of, and how many more things I do want to experience with my family, and show them that there's so much more out there. And, but also I already had like people come up to me and say how this like motivated them to take a shot at this, take a shot at that. So whatever it is, I'm never going to stop trying to do better, do more. And, I'll find that adrenaline rush somewhere. Maybe at the World Series of Poker table with my boy Colin one day. We'll be sitting there at the final table.
I hope so, man.
I want to get back to that wild child phase, if you like it, in a second. But at that time, did you know that this is what you were going to want eventually? That, you know, I'm in my 20s, I'm going to have fun while I can, but eventually I do want to settle down and get into this kind of slower rhythm. Or back then, were you like, I'm invincible, I can do anything I want, and you were just living in the moment back then?
Yeah, I was in like this weird cycle, like a weekly cycle where, you know, Monday mornings, I would be like, I'm starting anew, I'm going to be good, no more drinking, you know, I probably just burned a couple of hundred betting some sports games somewhere. So Monday was always the day to like re-cleanse your soul, you know, and say, that's it, never again, I'm good, I'm quitting drinking, I'm not betting a game ever again, and I'm staying home, and I'm going out to dinner with my wife next week instead of going out with the boys, and all this nonsense. And then by Wednesday, getting this itch again, where it's like, let's see, by Thursday, you're already making calls about the weekend, and then by Friday, you're back to the same old shenanigans. So it was very cyclical on a weekly basis in the moment, where I had to just break it. I had to just say, enough is enough, just break it. So that was what I had to overcome back then. But now it's like, I've completely just changed my brain. It's just crazy how I just am content doing just some real normal shit with my kids. It's just weird, but.
What were some of the highlights from those days? So you alluded to this, underground poker thing you ran where you got busted by a SWAT team, and I assume that's one of the highlights, but what kind of stuff was happening to you back then, and tell some of those stories if you like.
The poker room one is pretty good. So, you know, poker is illegal in New York, and gambling for the most part is. So I had me and a buddy Alex, we knew there was, this was back when Chris Moneymaker or whatever on ESPN, the World Series of Poker just became big, and the movie Rounders just came out. So we decided that there was a market for it. And we weren't the first ones. There were some clubs in New York City that had gotten started that we played at, and we knew, we figured out the dynamic, how it works and how you take a rake, and this is how the club makes money, and you got to feed these people and all that stuff. And, you know, the internet was just getting big, you know, at that time as well. And I make it seem like it was like 20 years ago, but it was a long time ago to where like social media wasn't that big, but like we had email accounts of everybody that we knew that liked to play poker and this and that. Anyway, long story short, we got a game going. We had this Knights of Columbus type hall that we had on a permanent basis, 7 days a week. They never rented it out to anybody else. We paid rent, and we basically had such a buzz that we had on average, even during the week, even we would have a good 40 players a night. Wow. And on weekends we'd have between 60 and 70, and we would always start the night off with a tournament at like 7 p.m. And most people would come for the tournament. And then after the tournament ended, or as the tournament started to break, cash games would start up. And, you know, we took our rake on the cash game, and we took a piece of the tournament the same way a casino does, no different. And we were killing it. I mean, we were killing it. I mean, I can tell you the dollar amount, but we were making thousands a week. All right. And cash. And it was a beautiful thing. And so one Saturday night I'm working, and a tournament was in full swing, and two cash games were going, and I think I had about $10,000 in my pocket. And usually I try to break the cash up and stash some here or stash some there, but I didn't, because I was trying to cash people out and this and that or whatever it was. And I had this stack in my pocket, and out of nowhere, the door is get someone's pounding on the door so hard, and I'm scared to death because I think we're about to get robbed at gunpoint. And all of a sudden, the door kicks open, and it's a complete SWAT team of like 15 to 20 guys, and they come in hot and aggressive and locked and loaded, and it's as if like we just kidnapped somebody and they're there for the kid and we're scared to death. And I'm like, oh my God. But I was relieved to see that it was the cops and not some crazy maniacs who were just coming there to shoot people and rob us. So one by one, ultimately how this works is now nobody's getting arrested except for the person responsible. But what they'll do is they'll take everybody's ID and run their ID and see if anybody has a warrant. So if anyone in there has a warrant, they're getting cuffed. But if you don't have a warrant, you forfeit the money you're in for and you get to go home, have a nice night. You lose every penny you came in with. But now, so they're making their way through all the people. They finally get to me at the end. We're all standing there with our hands above our head. You cannot move your hands. If you do, they will take you to the ground in a second. So I'm trying to think of ways how I can take that 10 grand out of my pocket and get it down my pants. So what can I do? And I'm too scared because I got a guy like with a sniper rifle, like 5 feet away from me. And I'm like, I'm not even doing this, but it's killing me because the whole time I know I'm about to just hand these guys 10 grand. So long story short, they get to me and I tell them straight up. I go, look, I'm the guy you're looking for. It's in my pocket. Just do it easy. You know, take out what you got. Nobody else is involved. I said, nobody else is involved. It's just me. Meanwhile, my partner Alex was playing cards that night in our club. But obviously, I didn't throw him under the bus. I took the heat for the whole thing. I said, it's me, it's me, it's me. So what's cool about – it's not cool. So long story short, everyone went home. They ended up giving me what's called a field appearance ticket. So I didn't get arrested that night, but I got what's equivalent to an arrest. So I still got to go home, but I was arrested technically. And then I had to go get an attorney. This, I know the story should end there, but it's a little bit better. And so the attorney ends up costing – me and Alex $5,000. All right. So it was money we had stashed in the event that this happened. It wasn't out of our, you know, we had saved this month earlier. This is our, you know, our jail fund. And we take the $5,000 and we pay off a lawyer who takes me to court and gets me 26 hours community service. So, all right, 26 hours community service. I have to vacuum these office buildings in my neighborhood. So the drive to community service isn't even that far. And all I have to do for 26 hours is vacuum these rooms after people go home from work. All right. It's an administrative building. So I check in the first day with my supervisor and I could overhear him talking about the Jets and how he's a diehard Jet fan or whatever it may be. And I pretend to not hear any of it. I go in there, I check in, I tell him my name. He says, all right, this is your assignment. Go here, vacuum, vacuum. All right. So I do 3 hours of my 26 hours community service that day. I go home. I immediately go to Dick's. I buy a Jets jersey. Yeah. I show up to work the next day. I made sure I listened to all the Jets talk on sports radio that day, as much Jets talk as I could possibly absorb. I personally hate the Jets. But I wore the jersey and act so nonchalantly. And I was like, hey, what's up? I'm checking in for my community service. And he's like, oh my God, you're a Jets fan. He literally puts me in his office. He sits me down. We order Chinese food. Okay. We talk about the Jets for an hour and he checks me off that I put in 5 hours community service that night. I did this three more times where we talked Jets football and ate Chinese food. And I think I did a total of 4 hours community service, but the court thinks I did 26 hours. And I guess that's where my Survivor game started many years
ago. Yeah, hey, that's a solid hustle. But I don't know if this counts as confessing to a crime, but the siren's on their way right now. You can hear
him. Yeah, we got him, guys. We busted him. Bring him in.
The supervisor.
Yeah. Finally got that confession out of him.
Working on that jury management early, it sounds like.
The supervisor being a Jets fan was the real crime.
So what was Kristen's reaction to all of this? Because she is, from what we understand, she's been with you throughout all of these different phases of your life. I imagine this was not her preferred phase through that history.
Yeah, we had many of late night talks where she's like, what'd you get into now? You know, I never did anything towards her directly. You know, I never disrespected her in any way. It was just my own shenanigans that I did. I don't know. She's probably just so disgusted with me. Especially, you got to remember, I wasn't taking care of myself physically either. And my wife has always been a knockout. You know, she always was into fitness, and she's always taken care of herself and done what she needed to do to make me find her completely attractive. And for me, I wasn't doing that for her. I was just kind of letting myself go and just not doing the right thing in that aspect at all. So there was a real dry time in our marriage, even, where it was like we almost even ignored each other for a few months, you know, a long period of time, where it was like we had no desire to even be with each other. I didn't want to be with her because I was disgusted with myself. And that just led into a real poisonous relationship, you know. And it's just, I can't even believe she stuck with me through all those years, because it really was just so, it was just so negative, the whole thing, you know, for many years, where it was just this constant cycle of like not giving her the respect or like giving her even the attention she deserved, and just making it all about me, me, me. And it was a very selfish life I lived, and it was all about what I want to do makes me comfortable. And like, I don't want to go to your family function because I don't like certain people in your family. Like, there was no compromise in those years. And marriage is all compromise and sacrifice and making sure you're taking care of your woman as much as she's taking care of you. And those years did not have much of that in it. And it's good that I recognize what it was lacking. And now, like, I go out of my way and she does the same. And we make sure that we take care of each other on many levels. And it's a learning curve, you know, whatever you want to call it. But whatever it is, things have never been better with us. And that's why I say I'm fulfilled. Like, I really am fulfilled. Like, this I know it sounds boring to a lot of people, like, what sounds to be a 9-to-5 life and coming home to the wife and kids and having a barbecue on the weekends. And I know that sounds like, oh, I hope that's never me. And I get it, because that doesn't sound like what Michael Yerger's doing right now, right? But I promise you this, one day, everyone who's living this big life will want someone in their life that's going to take care of them when they get older. You know what I mean? And it's whatever does it for you. You know what I'm saying? And this does it for me. And it's not to say this is all I do. I mean, I still do plenty of shit, and we're going to have a great time. But right now, my focus is making sure my kids are raised the right way. And it's less about what's good for me. And so in other words, I want to do that shit too. I want to go jump out of an airplane. I seek that thrill, but I can't risk that. I can't risk that chute not opening. I got a job to do right now. And to me, I find it fulfilling to do that job and be a father. And this is the point where you stop doing these fun and exciting things for yourself, because you're now doing things for other people. And that's what I need in life, because in my 20s, it was all about me, 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 and hitting the casinos and hitting the clubs and going to parties. And I live that life, you know, maybe a little more reckless than most people do, but I've had my fun. And now my reward is like the fact that I'm alive and in one piece, and I have healthy children and a smoking hot wife who does anything I ask her to do. And all this shit is what makes me happy. And I don't know, if that's not for you, that's fine, but it's working for me. And that being said, I'm good, man. I'm good.
Well, look, that end game should be personal fulfillment. And as long as your criteria for that are healthy and realistic, I suppose, and then as long as you're constructively working towards them, then there's not really much more that anyone can ask for you. And what those goals are, I think, is going to change over time. Yeah. Like, you at 25 and you at 35 are going to be maybe very different people with different priorities, but that's okay. And that phase of your life now is something that you can look back on and have good memories about, while understanding that now you've got to have a different focus. And it sounds like you're on the path you want to be on, and that's great. I want to open the floor to just give any other observations or stories. And I have one particular in mind that I've seen alluded to a few times, something involving a dog. As it pertains to this season of Survivor. I don't know if this is a time or the place, but I'm pretty sure it is. So the floor is yours, Tom.
This story is really... This story is like VIP only. This story is one that, first of all, there could be a criminally negligent component to the story.
That hasn't stopped him in the past, so that's we could knock down that barrier. But look, I figure we're almost 3.5 hours in. Anyone who's made it this far deserves a reward of some kind.
The dog story. All right, fine. I'll give it to you. You got to hear a little background first, all right? Because
let's have it.
The background pertains to my father-in-law, who I love very much. He's got a heart of gold, but let's just say he's partied quite a bit in his day, and his judgment sometimes nowadays is not quite there. And again, he's amazing. He's my father-in-law. I love him. But sometimes he baffles me. Okay. And his forgetfulness or his clumsiness may or may not become detrimental to people or living beings' health or humanity. Oh, now, I want to go into this saying that the story has a sad component in it, okay? And it was a complete accident, what you're about to hear, and there was no abuse in any way. There was no torture, no abuse, but it is a terrible thing that happened. And I want everyone to know that I don't make light of it, but the story really pertains about the aftermath. So if we can we'll get up to the terrible moment, and then we got to take it to the aftermath, and I have to set the groundwork because it's important and you'll understand why when you hear it. So my wife and I, for our honeymoon, we went away to Bora Bora. It was great, but we had to leave early because her mother was sick with leukemia and she wasn't doing well. So we had to end our trip a little short. So we thought we would reward ourselves the following year by going to Italy, which we did. And at the time, I think 2 months earlier, I had just purchased a purebred English bulldog. I paid a couple grand for him. At the time, my father-in-law had an apartment a few towns away in like a nice complex that allowed dogs and pets. So we asked, because his apartment complex was pet friendly, could we leave the dog with him while we go to Italy and he'll take care of him? And he said, sure, no problem. So we go to Italy. We have a great time. We do this. We do that. We eat pizza. We do all that stuff. And we get home and it's his responsibility to pick us up at JFK Airport. To take us home. And like I said, there's a history of clumsiness and lack of awareness from my father-in-law in the past. So as a joke, just kidding around, I said, how's my dog? Is he still alive? And he says, as a matter of fact, no, he's not. The dog is dead. And I don't know why, but he started laughing. And not laughing, I don't think, because he really thought it was funny, but I think maybe he masks his pain with laughter because he might have really felt bad about it. So the dog died, and I'm going to tell you how, and it's not great. And it was an accident, but basically he was in his apartment and he walked out of the balcony to, I guess, smoke a cigarette or whatever. And the dog followed him out on the balcony. And it was the middle of the summer and he walked back in not realizing that the dog followed him out, and he had left the dog outside in the sun on the balcony in the heat the entire day. And the dog died of heat exhaustion, which is terrible. Okay. Let me reiterate. This is a terrible thing that happened. I don't find any humor in it in any way. It sucked that it happened. I love this dog. I paid big money for him. All right. So my father-in-law kills my purebred English bulldog by leaving him on the balcony. The dog died of heat exhaustion. Okay, we got past that part.
We're good.
Now we're going to talk about the real component of the story. So as we're driving home, I'm like sick to my stomach. I'm nauseous. I just heard the story on how the dog died. I feel terrible. I'm like, I couldn't believe the whole thing was like eating me up inside. So as we're driving home, I say, oh, what'd you end up doing with the dog? Did you take him to the vet, or like, what's the procedure with that? And he says, I put them in a garbage bag and I brought them to your house. And I say, what do you mean you brought them to my house? He said, well, he's your dog and I thought you'd want him. So I brought him to your house. And I say, well, what did you do with them? He says, don't worry, I buried him in your backyard. So I say, what are you talking about? What do you mean you buried him in my backyard? Why would I want him buried in my backyard? Why don't you just bring him to a vet or wherever they go when they die and they handle it? Well, he was your dog and I thought you'd want him, so I buried him in your backyard. So I'm like, oh my God. All right, great. I don't even want to imagine the scene, you know, because as soon as I see this mound of dirt, it's just going to like destroy me. So the other thing he was supposed to do while we were in Italy was like mow my lawn, taking the mail, things like that. And when I got home and pulled up to my house, I saw that my lawn wasn't mowed. So I immediately, before I did anything, I didn't even take the luggage out of the car. I grabbed my lawnmower. I was like, so I was embarrassed that my property looked like this. So I start mowing the lawn. I mow the front and then I go into the back and I start mowing the back. And as I'm mowing in the back, I see this mound of dirt towards the back of my property. And I'm like, oh my God, that's it. That's it. That's where my dog is. And I'm getting like this sick feeling, but eventually I have to kind of mow in that area because there's grass back there, right? I gotta get the whole lawn. So I'm mowing, I'm making my way towards this mound, and I finally get to the mound, and one of the dog's paws are still sticking out of the ground. So I didn't know what to do. I ran in my house. I called Chris, look what your father did. What the hell is wrong with this guy? I called her. I said, Pop, what did you do? You buried this dog and you didn't dig the hole deep enough and the dog's paws sticking out. And he goes, I'm sorry. I dug the hole in the middle of the night and I thought it was deep enough. I didn't see how it came out. It looked like it was good when I was doing it at night. But you got to remember, he's a little klutzy. He's a little clumsy. He's not, you know, he's partied a lot in his day. So I'm like, oh my God. And I'm flipping out because I'm like, oh my God. So I'm still talking to Kristen about it. I'm like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And as like we're walking back out in the backyard to figure out what to do, I look out and her father, it's a true story, her father went in my garage and grabbed my hedge clippers and clipped the top piece of the paw that was sticking out of the ground. And he threw it into the woods. And to this day, the dog's paw claw is somewhere in the woods behind my fence. And this is it. This is what when I want to tell a story, this is a lesson to be learned about people getting married and what to expect from their in-laws, is that this really happened. He really did this. He clipped the paws off my dog's paws that was sticking out of the ground and fired them over my fence and told me problem solved. Okay? Jesus. You want to meet this guy one day? You want to go?
Can
have
we do a podcast with him? Can we do?
Let me tell you something. If you knew anything about him, he would be number one on your radar to get on a podcast, and they would want him on Survivor in a heartbeat.
That's what I was going to say. Can we get him on Survivor?
We'll take the entire Abate clan. We're not fussy. Just get them all on here.
He is not an Abate. You hear me? He is not my family. He is my wife's family. So that's the true essence of the dog story. Obviously, if I'm with you and I have a cocktail in my hand, I tell the story much better. Also, another thing you don't know is he's in the basement as we speak. He lives with me. Why he lives with me, you're asking? After that experience, why is he living with me? Well, that's some of the compromise you do in a marriage. You let father-in-law live with you even after he killed your dog. But no, he does not babysit my children, if that's the next question.
Yeah, jeez, man. How do you sleep at night?
No, he's not allowed to. If my children are near him, a supervised adult needs to be there with them.
Well, on that incredibly traumatizing note, Colin, do you have anything else to cover at this point?
No, just to say thank you so much, Dom, for coming on with us and giving us so much time and enthusiasm for all of these answers, not just on the podcast, but also I think the same was so clear with you out on the show as well. It was such a treat getting to watch you week after week and, of course, getting to talk to you today. So thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, real quick before we hang up, I just want to say like another component – like for a player who's playing a game, and this probably also even applies to players who just played and they're back and they're probably listening to every podcast under the sun. Trust me, that's what you do. There's this real cool evolution of listening to people before the season starts and hearing all your pregame analysis of us. And then the season starts and then we get to hear these podcast episodes and all these things that you guys put out there.
Sorry for whatever we said.
Listen to me. No. You have to be able to be willing to take the shit with the good and all that. And I appreciate all of it. And I think, honestly, you guys keep it up. You guys do great work. And I like I said, though, it's just funny hearing the whole transition to it. Oh, and I have one other question. Dom.
Yes.
4th of July just passed.
Indeed.
And I was always curious, like, what Brits do on the 4th of July. Do you guys hug it out? Like, what, how's it going?
I don't know. We go to work, I guess. There's really nothing to celebrate about it as far as we're concerned. But
no, I know there's nothing to celebrate. That's what I'm saying. I'm curious, like, is there like a thing where you guys all drink a 40 and, you know, sit around a fire and say, all right, they kicked our ass. This is a big day. I was always curious what the Brits do on the 4th of July.
From my experience, the Brits don't seem any more or less depressed than they do any other day of the year on the 4th of July.
I don't know why I was thinking that. Sorry. Anyway. Much respect, my friend.
Thank you. And thanks again for coming on. I guess as someone who has been through a lot and done a lot and has a lot of wisdom to impart, as has been clear over the past 3.5 hours. Do you have any closing thoughts for people who, I guess, maybe have the dream of going on Survivor one day, or just in general, just advice for people who, maybe not Colin's age, but maybe my age, who are younger and maybe looking for some direction?
I feel like I preached a lot tonight. All I was really trying to do tonight is what I encourage to anyone else out there is just do what works for you. You know what I mean? I told a lot of my story tonight, and I realized that, but it's because it's what works for me. And not what works for me works for everybody, you know, and just find what works for you. And once you know the right balance and the right chemistry to what is going to at least be what you feel is successful for you, just follow it. And if it means being a hustler and hustling to fulfill something, keep hustling. Or if it means, you know, going to college, whatever it is that you think is going to satisfy you and fulfill you in life, just do it. And the other thing I ask and beg of anybody and everybody is just be open-minded to everybody and anybody and do whatever you can to make sure you don't join any group or anything, whether it be religion or anything like that, that's going to create this scenario where it's us versus you and we're better than you. Whatever it is, I don't care. Just take on any situation fresh through your eyes and then judge it accordingly through your eyes. That, to me, I think is the healthiest way to live. And yeah, that's all I got for you, kids. So I hope you enjoyed it.
We very much did, for sure. Thank you so much once again for coming on. Is there anything you'd like to plug at this time, or where people can find you on Twitter or Instagram or anything like that?
No plugs. I'm doing, for any Long Islanders that may be listening, I'm going to be doing the Tough Mudder in Bethpage on the 21st of July. I'll probably drop dead doing that, but it's something we're looking forward to. Yes, there is something I want to plug. I'm sorry.
Too late. The time has passed. The interview over.
Well, myself and Chris Noble and I think Andrea Belke and possibly Wendell, the four of us, are kind of joining Chris's cause for MS. And I think the four of us are going to be attaching ourselves to a foundation that he's going to be starting very soon. And we're doing a big bike tour in October in Manhattan. But we're going to be racing together as a team around Manhattan. I think that date is October 21st. in New York City, and it's going to be a blast. And there's a whole thing they're going to do for it. A whole bunch of teams doing it. I'm still not privy on all the details at this point, but we did get the ball rolling on that. And I may be speaking out of turn when I say Andrea and Wendell are involved in this, but I'm pretty sure they are. And if not, I apologize, but I'm involved because Noble's my guy. And that's pretty much the only like long-term thing I see through that charity thing, the stuff coming up as well, but reality in August in Florida. And that's it. Living the dream.
Yeah. All right. Well, great stuff, Dom. Until next time, I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. British Dom is on Twitter at DomHRV. You can email us domandcolin@gmail.com. And to get our weekly bonus episode every Saturday, you can subscribe over at patreon.com/domandcolin. All right. Dominic Abate, one more time. Thank you so much for coming on, man.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for having me. And hopefully we'll talk soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks, everyone, who made it this far. We will talk to you very soon, I'm sure. Take care, everybody.